Welcome, Level 20, Episode 18, Habit. I'm Connor Smith, your host, Level 1 Summer Intern. This week, Josh and Friel and I had the pleasure of speaking with Tatum Minode. Super excited to share that interview with you. Before we talk to Tatum, though, let me tell you about what we got going on next couple of weeks. Romance shows, Sandpoint, Steamboat, Stowe, Vermont, Bend, Oregon, Boulder, Durango, Vienna, Keystone, Anchorage, Prague, Innsbruck, all over the place. Go check out the events page at www.level1.ski. You can also order a hard copy of the DVD if you want something beautiful to put on your shelf. We are still selling complete collections of all 20 movies. We have bunch of new sweet merch for sale. Our new 1.2 hoodies. Shoot, we killed it on that design. New Wells Lamont stock. Our RMU collab ski. There's a bunch of sweet stuff on the store for you to check out. Our digital release of the movie is November 5th. So keep an eye out for that. It will be on Google Play, Vimeo, Amazon, iTunes, pretty much anywhere you could want to watch this movie, there's a place for you to find it. Habit will be free to watch for 2 weeks only, so go check it out on the website. If you need a URL to find it, it's www.podcast.level1.ski. You can find this movie and all the other ones we've released. Time is running out for you to watch the recent ones, so make sure to go check it out in the next couple of weeks. I think that covers it. Enjoy. Episode 18. Oh my goodness. Sitting here in Denver and joined by Tatum Minode. Where are you at, Tatum?
I'm in Pemberton.
Where?
Pemberton, BC. Yeah.
Thanks for joining us on a Saturday morning after a Halloween party. That's huge. That's massive.
Big ups.
Yeah, big commitment. But I'm not too hungover, so this is going to go great.
Excellent. Excellent. What were you for Halloween?
I actually didn't dress up.
What?
I'm waiting until the 31st for the big reveal.
All right, fair enough.
Did you get a lot of flack at the party for not being in costume?
Well, no, it was like a super mellow Pemberton campfire hangout last night, so it wasn't really like the big Halloween bash.
Friedel led us to believe that you're up until 6 a.m and partying with the wolves.
Oh gosh, no. I don't party that hard anymore. I'm like a once every month, if that, type of person now.
Well, you just like, I just wanted to make it clear that this is not going to happen any earlier than 10:38. Which I don't know. I respect a Saturday morning. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Sweet. Well, we covered a little bit of your background, but I want to hear more from you about your childhood growing up in Banff. I think you had some ski racing background. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't into skiing or really the mountains, I guess, for that matter, until I was older, until I was 12. That was the first year I started skiing. But prior to that, I had a horse, so I was just fully into horses and gymnastics. And then, it wasn't until I was 12 that I like just decided that I would ski. And it's pretty much been my life since.
Was there like family pressure growing up in a mountain town to like be a skier, or was that not a thing?
Well, I mean, it's definitely bizarre that I didn't start skiing until 12, because skiing goes back generations in my family. Like, my grandfather was a Swiss mountain guide in Chamonix, and my dad, my aunt, my uncles, they were all on the Canadian ski team. So I'm like, we have a ski shop right on Banff Ave there. So skiing's like a big part of my culture and my family history. And I think it was just something that my parents never wanted to force on me. They really wanted to wait until it was like my decision and my doing. And so they just basically waited for me to ask to go to the mountains or for me to go skiing. And I did ask when I was like, I guess I would have been 10 or so, but I wanted to snowboard. So my dad was like, all right, like much to his disappointment. He's like, if you want to snowboard, like go find yourself a board. So like little 10-year-old me rocks up to the rental shop and like somehow finagles my way into a free board. And so I snowboarded for a couple of years, and then I guess it was just like my older cool cousin was skiing, and I was like, well, I'll try skiing. And then it was just like, boom, from there, it was my life.
Yeah. I mean, I should add that she's being a little modest, but her dad, Peter, runs Minode Sports in Banff, which is like an iconic winter sports shop, or I guess Four Seasons sports shop in Banff. And it is not only a very old and prestigious and well equipped store, but they also have like a humble brag wall, which has like the Minode, maybe even just a brag wall that has like the Minode family history, like and
it's pretty legit.
Pedro's up there, and now Tatum is also has some yeah, has made some appearances, not so subtle appearances on this wall.
I'd imagine.
But there's some ski racing photos, and I forget what else. Definitely your grandfather as well.
But, yeah, it's a bit of a shrine for sure.
Yeah, shrine. Exactly. That's the word. Yeah. Which, you know, yeah. you gotta like own it if you have that kind of lineage. I mean,
for sure.
Yeah. So little plug here for anybody passing through Banff. It's definitely worth stopping in and checking out. It's a really cool shop. Even if you're not in the market for something, it's worth taking a look at. I actually stopped by and said hi to everybody and visited 2 years ago. We're shooting for Zigzag.
Hey.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, awesome.
Support brick and mortar ski shops.
Do it.
Heck yeah. And it's not just ski stuff either. We've literally got it all, like women's floor, men's floor, shoe wear, climbing, backpacking, mountaineering, fly fishing, like everything you can do in the outdoors. It's friggin' sweet.
Minodesports.com.
Damn.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy ski racing? Was that a grind for you? I think people who like start out that way and move into freestyle stuff, I've like some are fans, some hate on it. What's your take?
I mean, I'm just grateful that I did it because it really shaped me as a skier. Like I have that foundation from learning like how to ski on ice pretty much and technique. And then now to take that into the bigger mountains, I'm just that much more comfortable on my feet and on my skis.
You're also talking to a ski racer because Connor has some history with ski racing.
I don't think anything on your level, but
I mean, it's fun though, right? It's like I met so many people. I traveled all around. Like I just feel so fortunate that I got to do it. And I guess at the end there, I ended up qualifying for the Alberta ski team, the provincial team, when I was 15, which is pretty young. And from there I was traveling all around Europe and doing like the NORAMs and stuff. And it was kind of like the last year that I was racing, I was doing really well in Canada. Like I had, I don't know, something like 30 slalom points or something. So I was like one of the top in Canada and I was feeling like pretty good about myself. And then we went to Europe for some races and I got so beat down. Like I just thought I was gonna crush it, and all these like girls that were 4 or 5 years younger were just whooping my ass for 5 seconds.
Yeah, they're made in like an Austrian factory.
Yeah, they probably didn't start skiing at age 12 either, maybe 12 months.
Yeah,
exactly. But that's when I was like, okay, I'm definitely not gonna make it. Like I suck.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're competitive though. That definitely, like, I don't know if that was born in racing or in horse culture, but probably more racing side of things.
I guess, yeah. I don't really know where my competitive nature came from per se, but I'm definitely,
Maybe she's like born with it. Maybe it's Maybelline.
Nature versus nurture.
Something like that. I don't even know.
Well, go ahead, Josh.
I was going to say, so you get back from Europe and tell us about your transition from pursuing this racing career. Sorry to take the words out of your mouth, Connor. Mm-hmm. But obviously gears shifted at that point. Tell us about it.
Well, I had an opportunity for a 4-year scholarship. I was either going to go to Bozeman, or to Anchorage, and it was 4 years of schooling fully paid for. And my parents were like, oh, you know, like, great. This is awesome. And I wrote my SATs, which I didn't do very well at. I was never very academic, but basically squeaked my way in there, and I had my bags packed to go to, I chose to go to Anchorage. And then a couple days before I was going to leave, I just bailed. I was like, cause the deal was I had to ski race for that, those 4 years at a pretty high level, like, doing NCAA.
Right.
Those were like NCAA scholarships program. Kind
of. There's not a lot of anywhere in the States.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So it was like for the 4 years of school, I had to ski race for those 4 years. And I don't know, it just dawned on me a few days before I was meant to leave for school that I just really was over racing, and I didn't want to do it. So like, I told my parents, I'm just like, I'm not going. And I thought they were going to be so bummed, like any parent would be, if you're shutting down 4 years of paid for schooling. And they were just like, oh, okay. Like, we support you. Like,
damn.
I was like, okay, well, I'm going to move to Revelstoke and just take a year off and ski powder. And they were like, okay.
Your dad has a funny version of that story, though.
Yeah,
he told it to me in pretty thorough detail, and I'm not going to remember it perfectly, but he was basically like, definitely one of these coming of age moments, but he didn't really, I don't know if he had like faith in you necessarily, but it was definitely like, we'll see how this one plays out. It's like, you know, he's pretty much like, well, if she wants to do it this way, like, this is not going to be like, she had this four-year plan that we can like essentially support, and this way is we're going to make it a little harder on her. Like, she's going to get we're not driving her to Revelstoke for one. She's got to get on a bus or whatever.
Yeah, like, it was like
sending you off in a bus in the rain type story.
Damn.
And then it was like, and then he was, I think, fully just like, yeah, she'll be back. Like, tomorrow, basically. Like, we'll see how this one plays out. Yeah, but that was just funny because I think he was just like, I mean, it was a roll of the dice, right? It's kind of like, and it seemed, I think, maybe a little bit spontaneous, which is never wrong to go that way, but I think he was definitely like curious to see how that one worked, because you were very much like shunning the system, following the dream. And that dream was like nothing more than just like hopes and prayers at that point, I think.
And Revelstoke.
Revelstoke, yeah.
Yeah, and it was, oh gosh, it was like the best year ever. I mean, it was before Revelstoke was really Revelstoke. Nobody knew of it. The resort was so quiet. There was never anyone up there. There was no such thing as lift lines, even on the deepest powder days. And I just skied every single day. And I lived in this piece of shit little basement suite. And just, oh, I loved it. And that's, I guess, really what just started my love for free skiing.
What year was that?
I would have been 18. So, frick, that feels like it was a lifetime ago.
No doubt.
And when you're getting out there, did you have goals in mind to try and still make a career out of freestyle skiing? Or are you just like bumming it and skiing for the love?
I had no idea that I could even ski professionally. Like, that wasn't even a thought in my mind at this point. It was just like, I loved skiing and I wanted to ski more POW, and that's all I did every day. And then I entered a contest because I still kind of had that like competitive edge, you know, where I was like still kind of missing the racing aspect, the competitive part of the sport. So I entered the Free Ride World Tour came to town, and I entered that as a wild card and ended up winning the qualifying day and then coming second overall. And
damn.
I got sponsored by Raj that year, and Rosignol, after after a few other successful stops on the tour. So it was like, that's when it dawned on me that, whoa, maybe I could actually do this professionally. Like maybe I can make money skiing. Like, what a concept.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah, I think that's fucking wild that shit happened that fast, because so many people like have to put in a lot more time than like 1 year to like see some like
results.
These are not small brands we're talking here to just be like, yeah, no, I'm on Razi now. Like, that's wild.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have like, I've had people within those brands supporting me from the very beginning. Like Rossignol did sponsor me as a ski racer too, so I was kind of connected with the brand already, and I've never skied on anything else, still haven't, so that's like a family to me at this point. And then Mike Nick at Arrange was just such a believer in me. He was the one that was like, we're gonna bring you to Ritalik. And those Ritalik trips in the early days where we'd do catalog shoots with JP and Charlie Egger, Banks, and the boys, like, that's really what the first time I ever shot and filmed in the backcountry, and that's really what kicked off my career officially, was those trips. So I've just been so lucky to have the support from these people in the industry.
Yeah, and that Arrange edit with the double backflip, I would say, like, really put things into full throttle. Like, where'd you learn how to do a dub? Did you try them into foam pits and stuff like that before? Or was it just like, I've done one in DePauw, I'm going to try two in DePauw?
Yeah, no, there was no such thing as foam pits or
airbags.
No airbags at this point. It was just like, build a big gold kicker and hope you got a soft landing kind of thing. Like, a little reckless back in those days, I guess, compared to now. But it was just something that I had thought about for so long. And I think I had just like imagined myself doing it so many times that when I actually went to do it, it wasn't that big of a deal. If you know what I mean.
Yeah. Just,
I can't say I do personally, but
conceptually, it makes
I understand
sense.
What you're saying. Yeah.
Well, it also helped that I had the boys there. And I mean, this is like my greatest memory of JP, just the type of person he was. He turned that day, like that morning, I kind of woke up at the lodge at Ritalik and I was like, guys, like, I know we're going to hit this big jump today and I really want to do a double backflip. And everyone kind of like got silent, and JP like looks over at me and he's like, well, that's sick. Like, sweet. I'm going to help you kind of thing. And he just fully coached me through every, like, he even slipped the in run of the jump for me. He was just such a stand up guy.
That and a true master of the backflip and double backflip as well.
Absolutely. Pretty sure he patented that back mute. That's where it comes from.
Couldn't have had a better teacher, that's for sure.
God damn.
Yeah, that's an incredible story.
It's pretty touching.
Yeah.
Slipping the in run. Wow.
On that topic, real quick, you mentioned Mike Nick, and, you know, shout out to him. He was really the one that connected the dots with you and I in level one. And but for his faith in you and giving me like a hard sell, like, this girl is going to be it. Like, you have to shoot with her. This is going to happen. Like, he was really the one that pushed for that and well, really made it happen.
Yeah, he had good taste. He really saw potential in people. And he, even over the years, like when he started Cyber Cartel and then moved to Arrange, it was like all those years, he was always picking out, I don't know, he had a, like, that's a skill kind of, it's just an eye for people that, like, you know, unformed talent or whatever, potential. And they had really good ways of enabling it or like keeping it going and giving it life or whatever.
Yeah, I just can't thank him enough. He was the best team manager I've ever had. He was like just a homie, you know, we'd go on these trips and he'd be shredding too. And we'd be like partying at night together. And then I knew I could always call him up and like ask him for business advice, even, or life advice. Like, Mike Nick is the man. Love you, Mike Nick.
Yeah. He should still be in skiing. Skiing needs people like Mike Nick.
Yeah.
100%.
What is Mike doing right now? Do we know?
I don't know.
working for like an agency in Burlington or something.
Hit us up, Mike.
Yeah.
The people need to know. You get involved with Level One last year, I believe. What was your first year shooting with the crew like? And making the transition from like doing the Free Wide World Tour comp stuff into film and doing that?
I think that's a better question, because if you're, the way I see it, that was almost an unnatural transition, because if you're already, a lot of people go from like film to Free Ride World Tour or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in the tour and you're competitive by nature, that's like a natural home for you. And mm-hmm. I think that you could have just continued doing that at a pretty high level and been very successful, to be completely honest. And when you were immediately like at age, I don't know, whatever, 20, 21, being like, I want to film. Because you were very, like, you said it to me, I remember it very well, but you were just like, I want a film part. Like, I want it now. Like, I want it yesterday. And I was like, damn, like, it was just, I don't know, like, yeah. There's not many people that say that bluntly, for one. And also just like, you were just coming off of basically, yeah, just Free Ride, that whole scene. So what was the mentality there, or whatever? What motivated that?
I mean, yeah, I guess I totally was like that. And looking back on that, and I remember Berman even talking to you. When we first met, I remember being like, "Hi, Josh, nice to meet you. I'm Tatum. I want to film for Level One one day." And that's exactly what you did. You laughed at me, and I was
"Oh no." Did I tell you to enter Super Unknown?
No, you just didn't know me. Like, who does that?
Where was that?
That must have been in Salt Lake somewhere. Maybe I don't even remember. I mean, it was so long ago, but I didn't know anyone, you know, in the community. I'd never met you. I was just so forward, and you were just like, you kind of just like chuckled. You're like, like, all right, I mean, I'll keep an eye on you kind of thing. We'll see.
Well, it all worked out now, didn't it?
Oh, 100%. And I'm just like so grateful that I did, that you did give me that opportunity, because filming with Level One was just so instrumental in kicking off my career. And it's really what's got me where I am today.
Well, glad to give you that platform.
Yeah.
Feeling is mutual.
Yeah.
Were there people that you were looking up to and seeing them film parts and wanting to emulate them? Or was that something that you just conceived out of nowhere and were like, I'm going to go film? Where'd that come from?
I mean, I grew up, you know, watching the ski movies. So, and especially seeing Ingrid Backstrom was always just such a mentor and a legend in my eyes. And watching her film parts, I was like, damn, that is so cool. If I could have one dream, it would be to do something like that. And then after I did the contest thing for a year, I was like, that was super fun. But just this idea of getting into the mountains and being creative was like such a exciting thing for me. And I just wanted it so bad. You know, I was just like so, so hungry to put my skiing out there. I just felt like, I just was at a point where I did have some like talent, I guess, that I wanted to show. And I was super hungry for it. And
yeah, you were hungry. You were skipping meals. You were goddamn out there.
Yeah, I guess so.
No, we had gone sled skiing the year before, 2013. So I'd seen you ski, and I was like, damn. And I think I remember Rainville or somebody being like, yeah, like just backing up your
style.
Your style. So, and like, the only thing that was missing there was like Level One is so known for just full on freestyle, whatever you want to call it. Like we rarely have like the big mountain,
mm-hmm.
or we just weren't known for that. So I think that was like the one question mark was like, okay, she's got like a really good form or whatever, but like, where does that
fit in?
Yeah, like how does that work? Because it was a lot easier, like when Kaya Tursky, for example, like, or I mean, anyone at really, but like, an example of another woman that was in our crew, it was like, well, she's like a street, she's like well known as like a street rider, and she can hang like super hard. And that just fit into our like program so much easier. Where it's like, mm-hmm. all right, so like, I think that was when you're like, I want to film. I was like, damn, all right.
Like, I would also point out that it's more difficult to give up and coming riders opportunities in the backcountry because yes. there's that much more of a challenge for one to get where you're going, for two to have mm-hmm. everything line up between schedules and weather and snow and stability and everything that mm-hmm. comes with it. And then moreover, like we have a long list usually of people that want that already in our crew, and we can't always accommodate everybody. So it's like, how do you break the ice with a new person and give them that first opportunity in that environment? And it's not easy because traditionally, if you look back at all the athletes that we've worked with from the ground up, 98% of them will either start going to park shoots or street shoots or something mm-hmm. where it's just so much easier to test the waters. And if it works, then people continue to go up through the ranks, if you want to call it that, and develop into, you know, potentially backcountry skiers, if that's where their heart is or not. But if it doesn't work, it's like, all right, yeah, you know, there were a dozen dudes at the park shoot. This person just didn't deliver and is not on it. And like, that's okay. No, mm-hmm. no harm, no foul. But to give somebody what's a pretty coveted spot, usually on a small crew in a backcountry environment, where it's not even like, hey, Tatum, come out for a day. It's like, hey, Tatum, come out for a month or, you know, a whole season to really figure out if it's going to work or not. So it's a lot more challenging to do that. And yeah.
Yeah.
True. Oh, for sure. The stars really aligned for me. I definitely, and like big ups to Wiley too, for looking back at those days. Friedel, remember that first, one of those first trips to Cook City with Darren.
Darren, I was going to say shout out to Darren Rayner too, because yeah. you know, that was a lot of his hard work that first season that helped break the ice and give you that opportunity.
Totally. Totally. It was just hard work for sure. And like not knowing what I'm doing at all, but just feeling like I'm ready and like, I want this and I'm going to ski super hard. Like, please point the camera at me kind of thing.
Yeah. And I mean, so much of that too is the process, right? Like that's the whole thing with a lot of backcountry skiing is like, yeah, you can ski just fine, but like getting to the point where you're dropping in front of a camera can be kind of a process. Like the sledding, the skinning, the understanding of the environment.
The rhythm of it.
Yeah. yeah.
But just like yeah. snowmobiling for one, I think that year 2014 was like you basically learning how to be a hardcore backcountry snowmobiler. Like, just, like, trial by fire.
Straight up, I was going to say.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? I'm curious to hear your side of that experience. We talked about it a little bit during the last podcast, but, yeah.
I mean, that was a nightmare. Trying to learn how to snowmobile that first year in Cook City was, I was on an 09, which is, like, that was before Team Ocean, and my sled had the super wide chassis, so the thing was, like, so hard to turn. Not side hilling was not an option, and I was trying to keep up with the boys, and the last thing I wanted to be was like the girl in the crew that's holding everyone back. Like that was just like my living nightmare. So every time I'd get stuck, I would just have this like this freak out of like, oh, like what am I doing? I'm really fucking the scene up here. Like I never wanted to hold anyone back, which I was fully doing, you know. So it was hard that first year, but we got around, we made it work. And Friedel, I think that's when we, you know, that was like when we really bonded, because you really saw my struggle, and you'd just come up to me and you'd be like, you know, it's all good. Like you're just kind of going to make it worse. If you're going to get in a bad way about this, like we'll get you out. We'll dig you out. No big deal. I got you.
Everybody starts there.
Yeah. yeah. Oh, totally. There's
no way to skip that step.
No.
No.
And you were like, you had, I think, yeah, more to prove there, more motivation to like master that side of things, because you, as you just said it yourself, you're like, I am not going to be this like weak link. Like, that's just not going to be me. And of course, you're going to have some fucking situations where you certainly are. But yeah, it's like, I was pretty, actually pretty impressed. And yeah, we got to dig some shit out or make a few trails from time to time. But yeah, that was legitimately your first year ever doing that. And I think everyone can say, oh, it'd be easy just to go out and do that. But it's like, it's fucking not.
No.
No, definitely not. Especially on those old sleds, you know, like not that an 09's even that old, but like just the technology has come so much further now where it's like, you can just look one way with these new sleds and they just tip over.
Yeah.
Just talk to your phone. Your phone hears you talking about it and it'll take you there.
Yeah.
What did it mean after having all... Friedel joked a while back that like the Ski-Doo sponsorship is the most coveted thing in backcountry skiing. So like, what does it mean to you to be there right now?
I mean, I'm like... I'm pinching myself. Like, is this real? Like, could not imagine if we, when those days in Cook City, when I was 19, 20, struggling so hard on my little 09, if somebody was to tell me like, yeah, you're going to be sponsored by BRP in a few years, I'd be like, no way. Like, that's a fucking joke. I suck. Like,
it's going to take me a few years to dig myself out of this hole.
One day, Bombardier will trust you.
But yeah, it's just, yeah, really, really, really excited about that. I just signed with them and yeah, I've got the new free ride coming my way in a few weeks. So yeah, it's going to be a nice machine to be out there this winter. And yeah, I can't wait.
What's the difference between the Summit and the free ride?
Basically the shocks and I guess the something about the arms. The arms are shorter and the main thing is the shocks though. They have like this incredible suspension on them. They're meant for taking huge airs, which I mean, maybe I am going to like a sled camp this December, funnily enough.
No.
Yeah. With
are you coaching or attending is a
no, it's just basically like a film shoot for their new line of sleds. And a bunch of the other ambassadors will be there. And I'm really stoked just to like kind of hone in on my sled skills more and more. And I don't know, I want to like hit a few little pillows or something. I'm definitely not going to send it off any cliffs on my free ride, but or like hit any big wind lips, but I'm definitely stoked to just keep progressing my sledding because it's so fun and it's just like a sport. It's a whole other discipline, you know?
Oh, no doubt. Is there a double back in your future?
Absolutely not. No.
Yeah, so keep hanging out with Logan Peyota and you'll...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, God. I watched that kid throw a backflip on his sled last winter up on Rutherford Glacier and it was... I was like a nervous soccer mom in the corner. Like I was shaking. I was like nearly in tears. Just, I was so nervous for him.
Oh, it's completely the opposite of chill.
Yeah. There is no chill involved in flipping a 450-pound machine.
No, I couldn't watch. I was like, you know, I was there to support him. I helped him build his in-run and just cross my fingers for him, but like watching someone just full throttle, just fully pinned to this like wall, this kicker of a wall, and then just soar into the skies. Like it was so intense, like so much respect to Logan.
Damn.
No. On a tangent here of snowmobiling while we're on this topic. I think, I forget which season edit, which year it was. It might've been 2015. The one that Strassman made, it starts with, I think, you going sledding in Whistler. It must have been, yeah, I'm going to say it's 2015. Anyway, your dad, again, was like, yeah, like Tatum made this great video, and all anyone cares about is that shot of her backing her sled out of the back of the pickup truck. He's like, that's all they comment on. Like, damn, look at her. She's like... tossing her sled out of, reversing her sled out of the back of a pickup. He's like, that's all anyone gives a shit about. And I think he was even like, you make gotta make sure to get that shot this year. And it, yeah, it's so funny for so many reasons, because A, that is completely true, that people are like, for some reason, that is such a visceral image. Anyone doing it, like just backing a snowmobile out of a pickup looking, is like this gnarly move looking move. And it's like, but the thing also that I remember is watching one of Annie Boulanger's, the snowboarder's first video parts, and she fully had that shot. And this is like over 10 years ago. And I just remember thinking, I hate this word, but I always remember thinking like, damn, that chick is fucking badass, dude. Like, which she is badass. Yep. But I was like, holy fuck. She's like, yeah, she's like hanging tough right now, like with that shot. But then when editing your habit part, Peter's words were like, oh, anyone, you know, were ringing in my head, like, oh, anyone gives a shit about us, her back in her side of that truck. And I had that shot. And I was like, well, fuck it. It's going in.
It's true.
Because it's like such an easy crowd pleaser. Yeah.
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 I was like, all right, what's the most badass shot in this part? Oh, yeah.
That's it.
Sled out of a pickup. Got it.
Oh, gosh.
You could have like the most beautiful turns down a spine or whatever, and people are like,
backflip onto a pillow.
Backflip on a pillow. Yeah, yeah. True.
So, oh, gosh.
So, year after Les, you go to Alaska for the first time, I believe, for Small World. I want to hear about that trip, your first time in AK filming heli stuff there.
That was the most dreamy. Can you hear me?
Yeah. I think we can hear you good.
Sorry, I have one corner in my house that I get service, so I'm just I'm huddled into that corner. that first trip to AK was like a dream. I mean, I thought that that's just how all trips to AK were, but I just got really lucky that first year, and I was skiing with Michelle Parker, Lexi DuPont, and Tanner Hall. So a very mixed crew.
Yeah.
But
we're the three best friends that
Yeah, we were though. We actually just fed off of each other so well. And Tanner was so supportive. I mean, I remember we flew out to look at Sexy Spines, which was like just perfectly caked that year. And all the lines went on it. And he like had shredded this really cool spine to like a closeout air, a cliff at the bottom. And then a week later it reset and we flew back to the zone. And I was like, hey, Tanner, like, do you mind if I ski that? Like, as unoriginal as that is, it was like the most aesthetic prominent line on there. And I had watched him shred it. And I was like, Tanner, do you mind if I kind of ski that line? You skied a bit different, but I do want to hit the like little closeout section at the bottom. He was like, fucking A, like, no way. That's sick. You should for sure do that. And was like, just lighting the fire more than ever, you know? So it was such a good crew, and conditions were just all time. I was like the luckiest AK trip of my life.
That's dope. Yeah. Sounds like the AK trip for Habit was maybe not as smooth sailing.
Oh no. It was that was definitely a hard trip. It still is hard. Like, I was just actually looking back on footage of that trip a couple of days ago, and I was like almost emotional. I was like, damn, that was the year of my Habit segment when Friedel was living with me, and we were filming every day. Like, we were on a mission together, and Friedel was like my coach. Like, honestly, we'd get out to these zones and I'd be like, well, Friedel, like, you know, like, what do you think of that? Or I'd just be picking his brain, because Friedel, you really are like, so you have such an eye for stuff out there. So I'd always be running stuff by you. And then when I got to AK, I kind of like didn't have my coach anymore. It almost felt like I just didn't have that. Like, of course I had like the crew there to be supported and pick off of, but I don't know. I just like really missed having Friedel, a filmer that I really trusted and connected with. And yeah, I just definitely got really unlucky. And that's when I had my really bad injury.
Right.
Thank you, Tatum.
Yeah. Just on that note real quick, I don't think that that's something that people necessarily pick up on casually watching ski videos, is the role of a filmer just in the overall picture of things. Like, you're not in most cases just there to capture things, and especially in a backcountry environment, and especially with, you know, just like that, the dynamic between a filmer and an athlete, it goes so much beyond what you'd normally expect. And I think Tatum,
it's
just
huge,
really explain how that works. And I mean, as you see it time and time again, I mean, that's such an important thing, is just the trust factor, the working together, the collaboration, the, you know, using beta that people are able to provide and direction. And I mean, Friedel has mentioned it. I think a couple years ago you said, like, you know, I don't even pull my camera out that often, and it's like shooting is 10% of what I'm really even doing in the backcountry. And that's that's really pretty accurate.
Yeah. And that trust is like, is
paramount.
So such a huge part of it. Cause I think we've been talking about it in this podcast, but like, yeah, just being like incredibly picky with your working dynamic. Cause that just makes all the difference in like filming a part, like successful thing. And yeah, I just feel very, very picky about who I work with and build trust with. And like, that doesn't happen it doesn't happen immediately. Sometimes it can, but it's like such a huge part of like success out there. And also just the whole, yeah, everything, like the multifaceted, yes, you want to be a good filmer and be able to get a good shot, but also you're in part like, you got to know when to like pump the brakes or kind of push something, or, and just overall be supportive, morally
coaching up.
Yeah. I mean, you did, it's, but that was really a fun season for me as well, Tatum. Cause like, I think that you had, obviously been filming for a couple years up to that point, but you had a serious hunger that was like unsatiated for sure. I was in, I started off after New Year's. Utah had actually gotten a huge snowstorm, and Thane Rich was building these gap jumps in Grizzly Gulch, and he was like, you got to get down here, film these things. So I drove down there right after New Year's, filmed these gap jumps, and I was there for maybe close to 2 weeks, but Tatum, you called me up, and I was at Thane's house in Salt Lake City, and you're like, where the fuck are you? Like, you got to get to Whistler immediately. And I was like, I'm in Utah.
I was like, hey, well, come here.
Yeah,
now.
I know. I was like,
Utah's done.
Damn,
it's over now.
All right. Yeah. All right. Like, but that was definitely like, it was definitely potentially I could have. You know, I mean, the way that winters go, you don't always have like set plans. So I was just kind of floating down there waiting for the next thing. But things were going pretty nicely with Thane. But then all of a sudden I was like, all right, I got to boogie up to Canada. And then I was supposed to go up there for like 3 weeks and ended up staying until the end of April. So.
Yeah. Well, Thane came too.
He did. Not immediately, but yeah. But I mean, that was like one of those situations where I could really kind of dig my feet in and just create something, which is really a fun process because you don't always get to do that over the course of a season with somebody that intimately. It was definitely like, okay, we are gonna create a fucking part. Like Tatum's gonna make, and you were so fully on board with it and like seeing the overall thing and like how that just shaped itself over the season with like things that you wanted to do and learn and like, I don't know, make there.
Oh, for sure. That was just like, I mean, I attribute so much of the success of my season of that habit year 2 years ago to you, Friedel. Like, honestly, you're just, I like to joke about you being my coach, but you're just somebody, like, I trust you as much as any of the athletes out there to just pick out lines, or we'll roll up to a face and you just have this special eye where you're like, well, everyone's kind of looking to the right and you look over to the left. You're like, well, what about that over there? And I'm like, oh yeah, that looks really cool. You're like, yeah, get up. I'll get you up there. Like, just so, so nice to have a filmer who you have that special relationship. And I think it's just, as of recently, just working with new people has been good for me, but it's like almost my security blanket's gone. You know, I have to like establish these new relationships and build trust with different people out there. And it's hard for sure.
I'm flattered. but it was also really like, I'm not, you know, like I don't have the ability to do what you do necessarily, but I was almost like living vicariously through that season, because the small little victories that you get like over, like through doing something like skiing and certainly filming for that part, I like was fully living. Like when you did that that natural like takeoff spine 360, that was like there was such a buildup to that moment throughout the season. And that was such like something, you know, like such a goal of yours. And I was like so invested in it, like, you know, that like when you stomped it, it was like, I was like living vicariously through that victory. Like, just, I don't know, such an awesome moment.
Oh yeah. So many awesome moments that year. I look back and that was just one of the best winters of my entire life. Like, we were working hard though. We were grinding for sure.
Definitely.
But well worth it. And just so, so much fun. Like, what a good snow year. And yeah, good time to be alive.
Yeah.
Did anything change for you before that season? Like, was something driving this all these new goals and like stuff to check off the list? Because listening to the director's commentary, and we've already talked about this, like, Friedel's like, yeah, Tatum came into the season like hungry as shit. what was going on in your head?
I mean, I guess I just felt like everything was aligning for me. I was just like physically in the best shape of my life. Like, I had never been skiing at the level that I was. And on top of that, like, my mental strength and everything was just so fire. Like, I was just hungry and super motivated too. I'm lucky that I had Friedel to work with every day, because it's like some people have all that, but then they don't have a filmer that can sled out super deep into the backcountry on really challenging days with them. They just don't have that opportunity to get the camera pointed at them. So, like I said, the stars just kind of, they just fully aligned, like, where mentally, physically, everything was going my way. And then I had Friedel there to like fully believe in me and point the camera at me. And it was just like, boom.
I think there's like a certain stride that people hit, and certainly you were hitting, where you kind of come into your prime, where you have, you had at that point had a couple years of experience, you know, not involving the years prior to that, you know, skiing in Revy or whatever, but like film, like truly like in the trenches filming experience, where you sort of at that point like learned the processes of all that. And so you had gotten that out of the way, and then now it was like really time to like let shit shine and progress, and because you had all the peripheral shit like figured out. So you were just like, okay, like, now we can really do this. Like, and you're just, yeah, the mental part of that is huge. Because you were just I'm going to fucking learn this. I'm going to learn this. And like, ain't nothing going to stop me.
Yeah. The learning how to film takes time. And it took years. I put in work before that habit segment, lots of work and years of figuring out how to, because you can go out and ski and shred in the backcountry and I'm sure you rip. But the minute that there's cameras involved, it is such a different game. So just figuring out how to to be professional out there and how to be safe and how to travel with the sleds and on the skins and through the mountains and then lining up film angles and waiting, you know, you're standing on top of like the scariest line of your life and you're waiting for like 20 minutes or half an hour and you're like,
or more.
Yeah, or more.
The patience game is like nothing else. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. It's so real. And you just got to go and like into this other state, just like find your happy place and just don't let yourself get you can't overthink it, or you can't let yourself get in a negative headspace when you start to like freeze up because you're just shaking on top of a windy peak for 40 minutes waiting for Friedel to say, all right, I'm ready. Like, light's good. You can drop. It's crazy. It's such a funny thing that we do.
It's such a funny thing. It is so bizarre. And like, really, you ultimately you do less skiing and all this stuff. But it's a good point that you bring up with that, because it's like, you see it a bunch in like hardcore ski towns, like Whistler is a great example, or like Bozeman even, where like there's all these local heroes and rippers and like so-and-so is way better than like so-and-so in your movie. Like they could be like, they could have the sickest segment in the movie if you just gave them a chance. And it's like, yeah, well, I'm sure they're awesome, but like, could they? I don't know.
Like, yeah, it's such a different game. It's like almost not skiing. Like, I hate to say that, but it's so true. You ski, like the years that I started filming, I skied like half the amount.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, talk to the street skiers. Ask how much time they actually spend with ski boots on their feet. We're talking like 2%, like single digit percentile of the time. Most is driving around and shoveling. And that's right. About it. I mean,
how much time has Tom Walsh spent in like a Suburban driving around with like
looking for handrails?
Well, it's kind of like Tom's version of his Suburban is our snowmobiles.
Absolutely.
Like, think about many times we like putter, we get out to the zone, which is like just so, it's like just backbreaking, you know, and you get out there and then we're just like sheep. We're just like moving around, like looking around. Nobody really wants to like throw their boots on and we're just kind of like freezing at this point or like, yeah, just like going from zone to zone, like not really knowing, like it takes some freaking motivation to throw on those frozen ice boxes and be like, all right, put me up there. Like I'm going to shred that like that's calling to me.
True that.
Ain't as easy as it looks in the movies.
No.
Yeah.
Word up. Well, we had a listener question that I want to get your take on from one Carolyn Werner, who wrote us a very long, very well-written question that basically boils down to, like, what happened to all the ladies? And I guess I want to phrase the question to you this way. Like, what can we three dudes and dudes at large in this industry do better to help women succeed? In filming specifically, I'll say as well.
I mean, I think you guys are doing great. Like, I think behind every female, there are supportive males that are cheering her on. Like, for example, I last season did this little giveaway where I was like, all right, girls, like, who's out there? Send me some of your best clips. I want to see who's shredding, and I'm going to give you guys a pair of my Rozzy Pro models. So I got all this content and all these video clips, and behind, it was a funny trend, behind every iPhone video of these chicks just shredding, mind you, there's a dude and he's like, yeah, you got this, like cheering her on, like just so supportive and like coaching her almost, like you're just drop a bit to the left or like hit it with more speed, like just I think it, yeah, you guys rule. And I think it's just so, so cool to see whether they're boyfriends or best friends or just male shredders out there just supporting women and skiing with them. And that's what it's all about.
Word. That's an awesome way to put it.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
I also felt like over the years that it was really nice to have it was really nice to have like different, to mix it up, like different energies, if nothing else. Like, I like the presence of different people. I think that like filming with a crew of dudes can almost get like militaristic in a way where you're like you're in like a a platoon or whatever, and you're just doing your shit.
Yeah.
But also, like, it's there's just different dynamics when, like, oh, we're going to make, like, an all-women's project or, like, an all-girls crew or something like that. And I think I just don't like segregation in general. I think it's kind of weird when people, I mean, there's like obviously like-minded people that you're going to align yourself with. Mm-hmm. But, and if that's like, that, I mean, if that's what works, that's totally fine. But I think it's always rad when people can shred together, because it's all about what gives you motivation, versus like being super segregated. Like, oh, we're only going to shred with, like, obviously you don't have dudes being like, we're only going to shred with dudes, but it kind of goes unsaid that is what happens
to an extent, for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, I think just because people are like-minded, it's just, you're going to align yourself with like people that you're homies with or whatever, or that you can shred best with. But I think you were like, I don't give a fuck who I shred with, that, as long as they're giving me a good vibe or, you know, motivating the group or whatever.
Totally. And it's never been the case with like any of the dudes I've ever worked or skied or filmed with. It's like, they're just, yeah, sure, I'm usually the token female, but it's not, I don't know, it's not personal, you know, like they're just out there doing their thing. And when I come into the crew, they're like always so supportive and so cool, whether it's like CeeLo and Parker or Thane or like any of the dudes, just, they're just as fired up as I am to like help me and to support me. And I think the future of women skiing is bright. It's, there's so much content that's I'm seeing from new up and coming women, and we just got to keep throwing it out there. I just tell, like, a lot of girls ask me, like, how do you do it? Like, how do you get your start? And it's easy. Like, just get your buddy to film you, you know, just put some shit out there on the internet. It's a big, big wide world. Like, people are going to see you. Like, if you have this skill and the talent, like, the film producers aren't going to say no. They're not going to reject you. They're going to be super supportive. And yeah, you just got to work hard and put yourself out there.
Ladies, enter Super Unknown. Come on.
Yeah.
Do it.
Yeah.
No, that's 100% right, Tatum. Undoubtedly, that's true. And that is like, I mean, I was really blown away by that contest that you ran, like seeing those submissions. I was like, holy shit. Like, there is a groundswell right now of ladies fucking shredding, like, that are coming out, like, the next 10 years or whatever, when they all really get into, like, yeah. It's when it's, like, going, like, yeah, coming into its own, like, as a full-on thing. I just think it takes people, any sort of groundswell like that takes leaders, right? Like, it takes the role models and people to look up to. If you never have people to look up to in a discipline or whatever you're doing, then you're just gonna probably go somewhere else where you do. So, like, I think that you're a great example of that, because you clearly are having a role in that, Tatum, I think.
Well, thanks, Friedel. Yeah, I think it goes without saying too, just that shit isn't going to get handed to you, you know, like, especially in this industry and especially as a female in this industry. I think it's just about like kind of just knocking down doors and like going up to the Josh Bermans of the ski industry and saying, I want to shoot in your movie. Like, just throwing yourself out there and like setting these goals and yeah, it's super important. I just don't think things should get handed to you. And if you have the skill and the work ethic, then you'll succeed. Like, it'll pay off for you.
Word.
Fuck yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing your perspective on that. And I think that was extremely well said. So appreciate it. Before we wrap up here, just curious what you got cooking up for this winter. What's on your plate? What's on your checkbox goal list?
I'm working on a new film, which is pretty under wraps right now because we're just still working on the budgeting phase of it. But it's going to be really cool because it's going to be an opportunity to tell my story from kind of beginning to now, like through my heritage, my family's heritage in skiing. And
sick.
Yeah, I'm going to head to Chamonix this winter. Ooh. When things line up, and kind of dabble my feet in that world, because that's where my grandfather was skiing back in the day. And yeah, it's going to be a feature film, but I can't unfortunately speak too detail about it at the moment.
Fuck yeah, that's awesome to hear. Yeah, that's a bucket list, I think, for you.
Yeah, it
you've
is.
Been talking about that one for
years. Yeah. I had this idea drafted up like 3 years ago, and then I got injured. But it's going to be really cool. And it's something that I've been wanting to touch on, for a long time. And now to finally get the chance to do it in a feature film is like really a dream come true. Cause originally it was just going to be kind of like a short video piece on the internet. So it'll, yeah, be a better platform for it to be rightfully told.
Excellent. That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
Any final thoughts from you two?
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, yeah, likewise.
I'm a big Taya Minot supporter.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever she's doing.
Yeah, just got to stay healthy. That's most important.
Oh, man. Truly.
Always.
Yep. Awesome. Well, any final thoughts or shout-outs from you, Tatum?
Well, no, not at all. I just, yeah, it was really, really great to connect. And obviously a huge shout out to Level One for kicking my career off and believing me from the very start. And yeah, freaking love you guys.
Aw, thanks. Oh, you too.
Hell yeah.
Thank you for joining in.
Yeah, taking the time on a Saturday morning. We appreciate it.
Of course. Anytime. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really stoked to be a part of the podcast.
I have a part two. Before we talk about the movie, let's get a quick update from you guys. The last time we recorded one of these was about a month ago. Leaves were still on the trees. The movie was in its final stages, but not yet out in the world. You guys have been out and about in Europe for a good while. What's going on? How's life?
Life is good.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah,
life is good.
I think that the last time we recorded one, because we had an option to record this particular Habit podcast, what would have been the final week of post-production leading up to the premiere. It was going to be that Monday, and we opted to not do it. Thank fucking God, because at that point, I was into the office at 7:30 a.m. on your average day and leaving at probably 10 p.m., which, I mean, that's a long haul.
Yeah.
And it came down to any time that we spent doing anything that wasn't directly related to the movie was going to either directly affect the final product or just subtract from the 4 or 5 hours of sleep that we were actually getting. So nice to push this one back a little bit and take a deep breath. And yeah, like we're saying, life is good. The movie has been getting a great response. We are 2 for 2 on winning movie of the year at the High Five Festival. And IF3, which, you know, awards are not everything, but it's definitely something. And it's really nice. It puts things in perspective, and it feels good because it's a pat on the back from the industry is how I've always phrased it.
And you got a honeymoon in.
And I got a honeymoon in. Went to Italy for 10 days. Stayed in a really haunted house, which was actually pretty nuts. I do believe in ghosts and spirits and all that crazy stuff, though. I don't know if I've ever quite felt the vibes that I felt in this place. It was kind of crazy.
The spirits were alive.
They were alive. They were friendly ish, but
I don't believe in ghosts. As soon as the lights go off, what the fuck was that?
aside from the ghosts, we drank all the wine, ate all the pasta and bread and cheese, and it was beautiful.
Lovely.
And then otherwise just been kind of keeping tabs on what's going on with the premiere tour. And again, just people have been hyped. It's been an awesome reception. People have really, they're picking up what we're putting down. And it feels good.
DJ No Request made an appearance.
Yeah, he did.
Was he taking requests this year or no?
Maybe been one or two requests in the mix. But,
DJ, some requests.
Yeah. I did a European tour leg, I guess, which was a very nice thing to do because Sammy Ortlieb has a huge role in Romance, as does Lucas Stoll Madison. So I did two premieres after the High Five Festival, which is fucking amazing festival and great for skiing culture in Central Europe. But went to Switzerland, did Sammy Ortlieb, which has been kind of a tradition, but we do a premiere there. And then DJ No Request comes on, does a 5-hour set. And then actually, I'm still recovering from that night, which was 2 weeks ago. And then
that'll happen.
Just this last Wednesday, did a premiere in Stockholm, Sweden, with Lucas Stoll Madison, which was such a long time coming and like kind of like a huge exclamation point on this month of playing movies, because we've never Level One, I don't believe, has ever had a proper premiere in Scandinavia that we've hosted.
Not that we've hosted. We've definitely done some through Free Fleet.
Yeah, that were part of like a festival or a tour or whatever. And usually like truncated versions of the movie. But it was so dope to have the whole scene, at least in southern Sweden, come together for a night to watch a movie. And I don't know. They have such a beautiful thing going on there right now that just felt really
good vibes.
Really good. But it's been like, yeah, we recorded Pleasure over a month ago, and that seems like a year ago because being in the throes of editing is so painful. And yes, trying to switch, like we've been making these podcasts in the meantime, and like it's really hard to multitask with
your brain.
Like bandwidth in your brain is kind of limited when you're all in on making this movie, and there's so much pressure with Romance to make it, like, you know, it's just had special. This extra thing going on. So we were going to the last minute. We were counting minutes on
you
that.
You dropping clips into the intro the morning of, like.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the morning of the premiere.
Right. Yeah.
The morning of what? The morning of the honeymoon?
The morning of our life.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, it's been fantastic showing. I love the fall. I always forget that, how much I love the fall.
Dope.
And like the energy in the air. And these premieres have been like gathering the tribes together. Oh, I try to hit as many locations as possible because you can see each scene. And like, man, playing a movie on a big screen is so fucking awesome. I just love it. So it's been good. But I just got off a plane from that last night, and now we're here to bang out some podcasts.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the concept for this movie, because coming off of Pleasure, there's some big similarities for sure in the narration, and but it's got something different going on, and even more, I would say, it has some like inspiration from Less in the whole like public broadcast type riff going on there. When did that come about? What was the genesis for this idea of having like a brought to you by viewers like you type thing?
So
PBS.
But I mean, how do you think to bring that to skiing?
I think it was just a jumping off from where we left off with Pleasure, which was
absolutely
trying to make a movie outside of our traditional like part by part movies. And I think Pleasure and Habit are sort of twins in a lot of ways, are like
two part series
or whatever. And certainly like those two movies are, I think, play broad, right? They're not like they're less of like this core intense ski porn movie and more of like broader concepts that play to a broader audience. I think LJ even mentioned it in Pleasure, but like
totally
how his parents can watch that. And we took a sacrifice there making those movies where you lose a little bit of like interest from like super core kids. And I think that Level One had just matured to a point where we we had to try those things. And I also think that Habit as a movie is probably the most concept driven movie we've ever had, bar none. I mean, way more so than even Pleasure, because that movie is structured around this concept. And that concept is a fake guide to skiing, if you will.
Right.
I think maybe was subtly influenced by the movie. Have you ever seen the movie The Boys and Girls Guide to Getting Down?
I've not.
Okay. So this movie,
have you, Josh,
I looked at a couple parts, I think, when we were talking about this initially as a concept.
So it's like this pseudo. It's meant to be this, like, essentially like a guy. Yeah, it's a guide to getting down, but it's a wink wink guide at like how to party and how to have sex and like how to do all this stuff. That's like, well, you just do it, right? Mm. Like, you don't need a guide to instruct you on how to do that stuff, but it,
well, it'd be nice,
but it's
some people it might be helpful.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like, and I think that other people, somebody was like, oh, this movie's like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which I don't really even remember, but
I never saw that.
better book than a movie, but yeah, good movie regardless.
Either way, it's like these, I at some point down the line wanted, I was like, I want to make a guide to skiing that's like very meta, kind of,
the obvious in a very tongue-in-cheek way.
Right.
Not in a, like, we're missing this and we're not aware of how overly stated these things are, because I think that was part of our acknowledgement.
Yeah. And it's like, yes, you could go into this movie like without any, having never seen understanding of winter or snow or skiing, but it's like all these things that are so obvious that, like, yes, you need snow, you need winter, like winter makes snow, and you need gravity, that like, I just want to go to like to the ultimate basics to explain this, and sort of just all these things that you take for granted in skiing or whatever. You're not actually teaching anyone really anything in this movie. This Habit does not teach you any of that. But I guess like the secondary concept there is the how to gain a habit. And it's a little bit pessimistic in a way, because it's like, I think almost this could have been inspired by, like, I was just thinking about today, but like, this is when Talty Dan had like the stop skiing account on Instagram, where it's like, basically like all the reasons why you shouldn't ski. Like, don't be a pro skier, like, don't go get sucked into this lifestyle, because it's so such a dead end route, but you will get addicted to it. And like, it was very tongue-in-cheek, but also like, it's true.
like true statements,
like, you know, there's so many like just dead ends. It's like, yeah, you know, like choose your own adventure style, where you're gonna be way worse off in 10 years than your peer that went to college and like actually did like do something with his life and is a contributing member of society, you know. So that, I think,
though, it is all relative.
It's like, I think with Pleasure, we're like, this is like a
the sunny side of things.
Well, this is what gives us happiness, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then in Habit, it's like, oh, it's actually what gives you happiness is actually a
what kills you.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
We actually discussed doing the third movie to follow this, which actually became Zigzag, and we decided it should be completely unrelated to everything else. But there's a discussion of doing like a third part in the series and calling it a Rehab.
Yeah, so Pleasure, Habit, Rehab. We were close to actually going to that, but it was like,
it was going to be darkish.
Rehab has some pretty negative connotations.
Yeah.
And like, it's like, fuck, we can't go that dark. And it really is like, what do people go to rehab for? Like gambling and heroin.
Yeah.
So like, we're just not.
Do we really want to sell skiing on that same level? Like, don't do this.
I will say, though, it is breaking your own rule to not have a third. All things come threes, you know?
Right. But you know what? There, a lot of these movies, and I think, I don't know if we touched on it before, they come in pairs. lot of these movies come in pairs. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's like Zigzag and Romance in a lot of where is a pair. Yeah, there's like a lot of other examples of
After Dark and Sunny.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's these, it's like a grouping of pairs. Mm. So that's where we cut off that trilogy.
Word.
But yeah, I don't know. As soon as like I got into this how to guide, it was like, oh yeah, there's like so many ways to have fun with this that I just kind of went down the rabbit hole of that, because it's the PBS tie-in, which is like the
Vicus.
Yeah.
Vicus, like the Visual Instruction Center for Abstract Skills.
Right.
It's just a lot of ways you can have fun. And like if people think it's funny or not, whatever.
Have you renewed your Vicus membership for this year?
Not.
The pledge drive is ongoing.
Yeah. If you guys are interested in a tote bag or a coffee cup.
You can also set it up so it bills your credit card for, you know, $5 a month, $10 a month. They call it an evergreen membership.
Hey.
I think.
Yeah.
But there's all these funny documentaries that were made in the 50s, too, about, like, how to be a good citizen. It's like how to, how to save money, how to, be polite or whatever that they taught in schools. So I was, like, going and watching all of these, like, yeah, basically, like, like upright citizen propaganda or whatever. And then
you used to have like an inspiration folder full of this stuff a long time ago.
I had incredible amounts of this stuff. Yeah.
And then, this is what Friedel watches late at night.
But, you know, we started to do like, yeah. I watch 50s
propaganda,
grade school propaganda. Yeah.
Well, for my money, I think it, I like it a lot better here than in Pleasure. I think the humor works for me a lot better than the like kind of semi seriousness of Pleasure. And what really I think drives it home is the like the archival footage mixed with like random internet footage slash level one footage from shooting this year.
It's what you would call like found footage, but it's a style of documentary making where you basically like tell a story through found footage if you don't have it yourself.
But that archival footage comes from your grandfather? Is that correct?
That is correct. So this movie coincided. Well, I should probably.
You mentioned that he made ski films back in the day with Warren Miller era stuff, but we didn't hear that much about it.
As like a peer group. So my grandfather, Victor Cody, was a filmmaker in starting in the 1930s. He's very there's kind of a skip generation there. He should be my great grandfather basically, because he had my dad when he was in his 50s. But he was born in I think 1901, so he would be in his 30s in the 30s. 1930s is pre-World War II. But he basically dropped out of the rat race. Like I think he was an accountant or something, and then he bought a 16 millimeter camera. We have footage of the 1932
Olympics in Lake Placid.
I think it's 32 or 36. It's gotta be 32. 1932 Olympics in Lake Placid, New York.
Wow.
So I mean, this is a reel that was at my house where like you can put it on a projector and watch people. It's heavily scratched, but you can watch people figure skating, doing a figure skating contest on an outdoor pond.
Wow.
Like old school shit. But
He
pursued that all the way through the 1980s and never to any great, huge financial or mainstream success by any means. But he literally filmed skiing from the 30s into the 80s, like 50 years. And played these. He toured the films, and then he also was a big outdoor photographer. So he would film. He would go to the Everglades and film fishing, or like the Florida Keys, or go to hunting in Wyoming or whatever. But
Well, it's a cool connection that you'd never know unless you pay close attention to the credits, because it ties it all together in a way that I quite enjoy knowing that.
Yeah, and it's like, again, he's not this household name. He's not a famous person in the world of ski film history. It's all Warren Miller and John Jay and Dick Barrymore. So, but he still has this unbelievable archive of skiing history. You know, there's like hot dog freestyle and Sun Valley and Heavenly Lake Tahoe and in the 70s and all that. But this this footage, these reels have been incredibly dormant. I gained interest in seeing this stuff because I was also like doing the same thing, right? I was filming skiing. So I was very interested in the history of this. And my dad and his sister had been keeping this stuff in like a vault, like a safe pretty much. But it's reels on reels of films. And he was inducted into the Skiing Hall of Fame 2-3 years ago now.
Wow.
And part of that induction was that they wanted to digitize one of his films to play for the thing. I mean, he has since passed. He passed away in 1986.
Right. He's not getting inducted at the age of 115.
Right. no, I was like 4 years old or something when he died. But were willing to digitize and do a ProRes transfer on one of his films. So they did that and they played it at this induction ceremony. And, you know, I'm sitting here with a ProRes file of one of his films, which I've never had, you know, like a fully HD video.
Cause that's not cheap to get it there.
No. And it's like, a delicate process. It's a very old, brittle film basically that hasn't been run through a projector in over 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, a really cool thing to be able to tie that into something that I was like a project that I was currently working on, which was Habit. And it was the perfect way to tie it in through this like archival. It just gives it like this cool look. So all these ski shots in these intros, anything that's vintage skiing is shot by my grandfather or potentially even my dad. But that's all archival 16mm film that's probably never been seen before in a digital state.
Damn.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. I had that thought when the very first time I watched that, I didn't know where it's coming from. And I'm like, well, what library you guys went to dig this up, and like, because it's not stuff you you would never recognize it because it's not been seen, like you're saying, but in decades, but
yeah,
cool.
I mean,
shit.
Yeah, I mean, and there's some gems in there, like the crashes alone are like unbelievable. Just some scenics and lifestyle, like all the stuff that's in a ski movie today, but from a different
bygone
era.
Straight up.
Word up.
Wasn't there a fire that damaged some of the content?
His house burned down.
That'd do it.
It was again in a safe. However, not waterproof. So the fire hoses damaged the film, the water from the putting out the fire.
Yeah.
So the film did not itself burn, but the water damaged it. So some of that film has like what the water made was mildew. And mildew eats away film. So, but the seven films that he made, a lot of the raw footage, I guess, was kind of ruined. But the seven films that he did make were pretty well preserved and certainly enough to do an HD transfer of. So, But I don't know. I'm glad that you like enjoyed the watch of Habit because it was sort of an experiment, but it was really fun to make it in the way that we did because it tied in feature segments again, which we did not have in the last two movies. We didn't have in Small World or Pleasure, but you could do it in a pretty like, I don't know, felt like a fun and just not overly clever, but like somewhat interesting way.
It's fresh.
Adding some new context.
Yeah, and we're like, I don't know, like the whole wordplay or word association stuff I've been just like fun. Thinking about over the course of the season. Like we use all this like slang and terminology.
Corn. Champagne.
Yeah, like that my mom always was like even talking about. She's like, you guys speak your own like you have your own like Well, it's like a dialect or language, pseudo language. So, yeah, it's like cheese wedge and corn snow and.
That's why my mom can't listen to these podcasts. Yeah. Like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah.
But... you guys speaking pig Latin.
Use real words.
Word. Well, let's talk about the skiing.
Yeah, word.
Keegan Kilbride / Will Berman, opener. But Keegan Kilbride's, like, debut in a level one movie where Chili had been around for a little while, and that shit slaps. Like, that... yeah, I'm going to struggle to describe it. Josh, I think you shot a good bit of that. What was it like shooting with Keegan that season?
It's real good. Like you said, it slaps. And, you know, big nod to Keegan coming off of winning Super Unknown the prior year. This was really our first opportunity to work with him. And I had some pretty serious high expectations because I knew this kid was really good.
Mm.
But he blew my expectations out of the water, I think, in every way, start to finish. And interesting watching the film earlier today, not only does he have what is effectively an opening part, but he also has the, if you want to call it the starring role, really holding it down in the Russia part. Mm-hmm. And then additionally has a whole bunch of heavy, heavy bangers in the closing park part at Mammoth.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd combine all that stuff, it probably would have been a 5-6 minute standalone part, something like that. I mean, it really could have been. I think he won the equivalent of like the Rookie of the Year award, I think,
Powder Awards.
And Powder Awards that year, maybe. And definitely opened a lot of eyes, turned a lot of heads with it, which was so cool to see. Though it's interesting, one of the stories that I remember, it snowed like first or second week of December, something like that. Mm. And Keegan had been living up in Summit County, and I think it was a pizza place that he was at, and I think it's one of the opening shots where he does like a cork 3 hand drag over a basketball
net. It's the opening shot.
Yeah, okay, it is the opening shot.
Yeah,
so we had set that up and the sun was like probably half an hour away from setting, and his phone rings and it's his boss at this pizza place, and you know, he just kind of like walks away and is like clearly like talking to his boss, and I don't know if he got fired or quit. It was one or the other. But like,
well, that's all relative, right?
Depends on who's telling it.
Yeah, exactly.
I wasn't fired. I quit. Like, he didn't quit. I fired him.
Well, regardless, like whatever it was straight up in the middle of this shoot. Like definitely like took a break to like answer this phone call and deal with it. And it's like, yeah. This is my job now.
No shit.
Yeah. Oh man, I should revisit that one with him and figure out exactly what the story is. But I remember just like wishing I had been able to roll on something like that. Cause like, holy shit, that's fucking real. Like this is this kid on the come up and like
he's joining the lifestyles of the poor and unknown.
Absolutely. In every way. It's like, I am no longer, tossing pizza dough. I'm getting winched into basketball hoops at 50 miles an hour. But yeah, it was really cool working with somebody who just like stepped right into it. Like there was no like really warm up or adjustment period. Like he, between his skills and his vision, his creativity, like everything was just like next level. And it's really, really cool working with people like that, where there's no adjustment. It's just like go time, getting bangers from day one.
Mm.
I wish that could be that way with everybody. That'd be awesome. Everybody winning Rookie of the Year.
Yeah. Just like
logging 6 minutes worth of content. It'd be insane. But yeah, it was pretty awesome working with Keegan. And then obviously tying Will Berman in, like those guys, not only do they have a very similar style just in their skiing, but in what they're looking at as far as features, and they're good buddies. They get along real well.
Mm.
So it was really cool to be able to put, again, skiing with your friends, right? And, you know, put people together that are vibing. And I think that's one of the things that helped Keegan succeed, is because he was working with these people that he was really comfortable with. And, you know, Chili was definitely that person. And, you know, then on top of that, that was the first year that we worked with Ethan Timmons, E-Money,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, just on a whim, like those dudes wanted to go to the Midwest. We're like, oh, we want to do this. And I wasn't available, and it's like, all right, cool. E-Money, we're going to send you off with this camera. Go shoot the guys for a couple of weeks. Hope it works out. And it did. And it really did. But
sick.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah. Yeah, Friedel, in the director's commentary, you like kind of lightly made a Wallish comparison talking about Keegan. You may not remember that, but it happened. And that was actually what I had written down in my notes prior to hearing that, was that this feels like the hardest rookie part since like Wallish and Turbo. Like,
yeah,
it just like comes out of nowhere. And I mean, if you're paying attention, you knew Keegan from HG Skis, but like, I think there's a lot of people who did not, who saw this and were like, what in the fuck?
You know what this part reminds me of is Wallish's opening part in Refresh.
Yeah.
The vibe of the song, the like vocal chorus.
The song is
like,
similar. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then just the skiing, like he just kills it.
Yeah, I don't like to make direct analogies or comparisons to like sure. skier versus skier or whatever, but I guess I did, and I'll do it again. but he's probably like, he has that Tom Wallish like modern technicality or whatever that's so on point with shit, and it's like, and DeLorme, and I know Berman has always made those comparisons too, but like mm-hmm. this Wallish meets DeLorme thing where DeLorme has this skis with
special sauce.
Yeah. Mm. Mixed with, it's like finesse mixed with raw power and like yeah. strength. Like, yeah. So it's those combinations which gives him that je ne sais quoi, you know, but it's nice. And
nice is right.
Yeah. 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 So there you go.
Word up. Let's talk about that Russia part, jumping off of that.
Oh, man. Yeah, you're taking the words right out of my mouth here. This is where I was going to go next.
That shit is fucked up.
Dude, it makes... I don't think I've ever watched a ski segment where I feel anxious throughout it. Because after the second crash happened, where first, like, Laurent, maybe hardest crash in level one history? I don't know. That shit's up there. Like,
that's gnarly.
It's insane gnarly. And then it gets into the skiing, and you're like, oh, okay, now we're in the skiing.
We're beyond the
horror show. The trauma. And the, right. Exactly. And then Keegan gets his face fucked, and then you're in the hospital watching him get his lips stitched together. And then there's just this, like, tension the whole rest of the segment. Like, who's going to get blown up next?
Well, totally, dude.
Crazy story about that. So, super international trip, and in a lot of ways, listening to the director commentary today, it's like the super unknown filmer unknown trip. So
yeah,
we got Danny Kush, who won second year of filmer unknown. We got Robin Lee, who won first year of filmer unknown. Well, I guess Noah is probably the only person that didn't really come through super unknown, but mm-hmm. Laurent, while he didn't win super unknown, that's where we really right. first got our introduction to him. And then obviously Keegan coming off his win, but, yeah, it was definitely like the farm team trip in every way, but at the same time, like the collection of like super heavy hitters on both sides of the lens.
Yeah.
And I remember Danny hit me up. I was like the second day where Laurent hit his head. And Danny hit me up and he's like, hey man, like this just happened. It's pretty bad. Laurent probably needs to go home like immediately. And it's just like, fuck. Like that is not how you want to start off like a 2-week trip. No. Like that's... it's fucking terrible. Like we're talking like I hadn't even realized that the trip had really kicked off. Like those dudes could be scouting for all I know.
Totally.
All of a sudden I get this call and it's like, God damn it. And then another day, because of the time zone difference, I want to say it was like the crack of dawn the next morning, my phone rings and it's this number from Maine. And I don't remember if I picked up that first call or they kept calling, but I picked it up and it's Keegan's dad. And he's like, do you know what happened? Like, my son's really hurt. Do I need to, like, bring him back over here? Like, I need to get him on a plane. I was like,
damn.
No. It's the Swiss kid. It was Laurent. Like, Keegan's fine. And he's talking about, like, plastic surgery and his face. And I'm just like, no. Like, it's cool. Keegan's okay. Like, it's Laurent. And I think Laurent's going to be okay. And, like, got off the phone with him and then, like, check Facebook messages. And there's, like, another series of messages. And it's like, oh, yeah, like... Keegan needs plastic surgery. His lips kind of got ripped off and we're getting him like emergency surgery into like the second hospital. Like, are you guys fucking kidding me? And then of course it was like a day or two later, we're like, yeah, Noah's knee is kind of hurt again. he might not be able to ski. And it was like, oh my God, like this trip is not even going to happen. Mm. And I mean, that's the least of my concerns, to be honest. At that point, it's like, well, let's make sure these dudes are cool. And, you know, Laurent somehow spoke to his doctor in Switzerland, and somehow they figured that he was okay to hang out. And I mean, I'm really shocked that he gritted his teeth and bared it through the rest of that trip. I know he took like the better part of a week off, but the fact that, you know, following up on what is a serious, you know, traumatic concussion. Him. Yeah.
It's certainly a helmet awareness
situation.
Because it could have killed him. It could have done a number of things. It could have like split his skull open for sure.
Yeah.
And I think that pound for pound, that's the most violent crash in imagery that just gets me every
it's
time.
Visceral.
It gets everyone, any audience I've ever watched.
Yeah.
I've watched Habit with quite a range of people.
Yeah.
And it's like, you just know this is coming and people are not ready for it. But I watch it again after, you know, probably not watching that movie for at least a year or two. And it's like, oh my God, how awful is that? And then the up close shot of Keegan's lip is horrifying too.
Yeah.
That's a hamburger lip.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
He's like,
and that is
that
like,
thing needs some seasoning.
The most unlucky of circumstances.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Are you fucking kidding me? He more or less comes off the end, greases this rail. His binding's like, unclick and somehow the ski like catapults up and like nose of the ski into his mouth. Like, how does that happen? Like,
no,
it
doesn't. You can watch the clip five times in a row and it still doesn't make sense.
Well, it's like, funny too, because those dudes, you know, told me exactly what was going on. I'd been in touch with them. I'd seen shots of his lip and talked to him and his dad and everybody else. And going through the footage, I'm looking for this horrific crash. I mean, they didn't tell me just like how like haphazard, just like unlucky it was. And I remember actually like watching this clip for the first time being like, what was that?
Was that it?
You're blanking, like, you'll miss it.
Yeah. Straight up. And like it's the kind of thing that he didn't see coming either.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a lot of, you know, crashes to some extent, when you experience them, you're able to react. Even like a fraction of a microsecond, your body goes into like self-preservation mode, and you can either roll a certain way, you can move your body, your face a certain way to protect yourself, and
go limp.
Absolutely. Like all these things that you see time and time again, like in people, like, you know, are able to survive or make it through crashes with minimizing their injury. But there are things where you never see it coming.
Yeah.
And if you don't see it, like, there's no way to prepare.
Sucker punch from the tip of a ski.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's true of the Laurent's crash, too. Like, it just comes out of nowhere. Just
Very abrupt.
Yeah.
Certainly no time to brace for impact on that one.
No. And maybe the worst country you'd feasibly be skiing in, I don't know, maybe India would be worse. We talked about that last time. But
yeah,
like,
I think I'd trade out India for an accident in Moscow, at least.
Because
I think that
Moscow's a first world city, but I don't think that Russian healthcare has a great reputation.
Yeah, that's what I'm
I just at. Watched the or Josh was there too, but the Eric Pollard documentary that he made, where he,
that you saw this at High Five, you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. And he touches on his leg injury where he broke his leg in Russia and got compartment syndrome. And it's horrible.
Yeah.
But he had to go to what basically saved his leg was being evacuated, for lack of a better term, to Germany to get some proper medical care. And I think that was a fear of Keegan as well, because
absolutely.
Did he not get secondary surgery?
Oh, he did.
Yeah.
So they went to like the first hospital, like whatever it was.
Which is like a walk-in clinic style. Right. Like,
yeah. And it's like, yeah, give us a ruble and we'll just like do something.
Yeah.
And they put some kind of stitches in his face and they walked out and it was like very recognized by everybody. Like whatever they had done would leave horrible permanent scarring if it would even heal at all. And it was like, this is oof, fucked. We need to go somewhere else. And so then Danny took them to like a proper like pay for clinic. But even then, I think it was $100 US to get this fixed relatively properly. And you know what? They definitely did a good enough job to the point where you can not even tell. Like, I haven't noticed a scar on his face.
Yeah, they did like a cosmetic. Great facial lines.
Yeah.
They did like some cosmetic repair or whatever they do to really like touch up a facial injury that.
But so. It was definitely done properly round two. But the fact that it took two different tries and two different locations that everybody's like, holy fuck, dude, you're going to be scarred for life. We got to do this over and like go somewhere else. Imagine that in the States, like getting stitches in your face and then being like, ooh, this is going to disfigure me. Let's go get these taken out and do this again.
Yeah.
And then somebody was saying something about like there wasn't even proper like Novocaine or like a local anesthetic. And it was just they're giving him vodka.
Is that real?
Yeah. Was that?
Keegan, tell us if that's wrong. But it sounds pretty right.
That sounds incredibly Russian, but that sounds like something we just make up.
Yeah, that's true. Like,
oh, dude, I had Novocaine. What are you talking about?
Actually, it was a needle full of vodka. not Novocaine.
But both of them skied again on that trip, correct?
Yeah.
Not only skied, but like did some pretty heavy shit.
Yeah, Laurent has hammer of an ender with the 180 through the pillars, extremely beautiful shot that I'm a big fan of, and big hammer, and putting that shit down is it's cool to be able to talk about that, because watching that and you know the way the segments laid out is as you've described it, pretty chronological. Like this shit happens at the start of the trip, and then we're in like recovery mode after. But you could edit it. You could cheat that. You could.
For sure. You could give an alternate version.
It could happen at the end and nobody skied again and you shop it so that it looks like this, you know, they're back at it. But like that actually happened.
Oh, yeah.
That was
straight up chronological.
Straight up. Yeah. And poor Noah is dealing with this horror around him. And Noah has had his fair share of injuries over the years. But
talk about vibes on a trip.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Like his reaction shot to Laurent's crash is like pure agony.
Looks like he's gonna cry.
Yeah.
Like he's gonna cry.
I would have cried.
Yeah.
God damn.
And meanwhile, he's dealing with his own knee injury where, you know, he hadn't probably healed 100%. And at that point, he would ski for a day and have to take 2 or 3 days off and ice his knee and then ski for another day. It was like the walking wounded. But, you know, pound for pound, it's one of like the heavier parts, if not the heaviest action part, I think, in that whole movie.
It is. It's certainly in the scope of like street stuff too. Like it is.
So we'll talk about LJ as well, because LJ is five minutes of hammers.
I think there's a lot of other six. I find it hard to agree with that just because of how.
Maybe it's just because of how intense it is.
Yeah. I can't appreciate the action whether or not it's good because I just have that anxiety that I was talking about. Like, I'm like on pins and needles waiting for the next to land.
All right, Connor, open your eyes up. You can watch now. There's no more blood. Another shot that I want to call out in there, which I don't know if people grasp how insane it is, but Keegan, like, disasters into the middle of a six kink or quad kink or something like that, where it's like a complete, like, fall away on the right hand side and just
full commit.
I mean, that has become more or less his style on some of these things, which is interesting because it's a lot of rail stuff too, which you know, if I had to look into a crystal ball back in the day, I would not have thought Keegan's street stuff would really go in the direction of lots of, you know, crazy rails, but that's where he's taking it. But some of these things are just like so gnarly, full commit. I mean, it's like this year gapping into the side of that other, you know, six kink right in, you know, sliding a quad where it's like you're airing into this staircase on a center fucking rail.
Yeah.
And there's no way out.
Yeah. But something I do in the general scope of things in the street in this movie, there is a big presence of real ski street, like X Games footage.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what makes Keegan's part and Russia stand out a little more to me anyway. And again, it's like it doesn't really matter, but like this season, Will Wesson, LJ Stranio, and Kai Capella all filmed for X Games Real Ski Street. So they're all three of those parts, they don't have like an asterisk next to them, but they are, they were already,
the content's out there.
Yeah. So it like in like, I think in my mind anyway, and again, this shouldn't like affect the film in any way, but that's like, it was already, they
it
were
doesn't
just,
count.
No, it's not that it doesn't count. It's just diluted because you've already seen it before. Yeah. So it just doesn't have an impact for you anymore.
See, it's interesting because like, I completely forgot that because the only real ski I remember from that year is LJ's.
Yeah.
And and watching the Will and Kai stuff, I was like, oh, hell yeah. And
Will has some, I mean, his heaters in Will's, Will has, a, you know, Will shares a part with Sammy Orley but, mm-hmm. in Habit, but his heaters are all from filming for X Games round two.
Right.
That was the year that he didn't podium. Mm-hmm. But like that, like in between nugget, like,
talking like the underslide on the double rail, like where he
does like a
in Finland on the staircase, it's a double wide rail, and he like gaps to like dips his tips into and between.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the like the 50-50 like inside the rails. So rails.
But
you're right, that other shot that as too. Well. Yeah, but there's some hammers from there, and LJ's obviously. Some of those shots are like LJ's most famous, if you will, shots. Obviously, the backflip to pillar, which we spoke about with him last episode. But
I will say, I think that I like that segment a lot, even as repackaged. I don't know. There's some really good stuff that some scraps that didn't make it into his real ski that padded out very nicely, and I. Let the editing on it showcases how hard he works for it, which you don't see unless you watch that whole 30-minute crash reel that Jake put together, which it's not for everybody.
It's like a 3-hour podcast. Yeah,
exactly. Oh, there's never been, I've never had any problem repackaging footage like that if you present it in a different way. Like a great example of that is what Phil Casabon and Brady Perrin have been doing with their last two X Games where, you have the minute and a half, 90-second video that goes into X Games, which is just all basically hammers presented as eloquently as you possibly can.
Yep.
And then you have the director's cut, if you will, which is like a way more
involved
thing that can breathe a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that's what we kind of did with, or, you know, that's what Johnny did editing LJ's part in Habit, is that he took this heavy concentrate LJ footage and let it breathe a little more, combined with some new stuff for sure. But I think that that is presented in an entirely different way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. And it probably does it even more justice in a lot of ways.
I think from like the sales and response side, things were definitely a little light from what I heard from our distributor on Habit. And one of the things, like, I couldn't come up with any reason, because I think it's a very comprehensive, like, nicely done film. And like one of the things we discuss is like maybe all this repackage, repurpose X Games stuff has something to do with it, because we couldn't come up with anything
else. It was a lot.
Yeah.
Like it was really a lot. Like those are three big heavy like parts. Like Kai's part is pretty much all real like X Games footage repackaged. LJ for sure. And then same with Will. I mean, it is what it is. I think we were just like, well, like we're not gonna cut these guys out of the movie or not use that footage, but it factored in, and it's like looking back 2 years later, it's like probably a different viewing experience for you versus like us when we're editing it and being like, oh, damn.
You know? Yeah, because I didn't see it at the time, to be honest. The first time I watched it was in June. So like I saw those real skis at the time, but I don't remember them vividly. And so watching it now, I'm like, oh, these Kai clips are really sick. Like his style is pretty different. Yeah, I don't know. He has a lot more like wall ride redirect shit going on than like his parts previously. I would say it's fresh stuff from him. So
well, that is the nice thing. Like as time goes on, these movies live as a very self-contained thing on their own. And it's not like, oh yeah, let's all put on like the X Games Real Ski from 2017 and watch them all together.
Right. It's like,
Wow.
Yeah.
Some people do that, but
in a less celebratory manner.
Yeah, no, it's not it's not, my friends don't like it nearly as much, but
yeah.
The endless pump track segment fits really well into the theme of habit. Did that come around? Was that a coincidence that that works out like that, or was that part of the thought process?
It's a coincidence that it works out that well. And when we are building these structures around it, it's like, oh, this is just perfect. Yeah. Like, but, you know, I know where this part goes in the, you know, in the sequence of things. Yeah. But that is the first of basically Sammy Ortlieb's trilogy of conceptual segments for Level 1 movies.
Mm-hmm. Unleashing Sammy and his creativity.
Which started for this pump, you know, continual motion pump track. And then...
Is that in Switzerland? Where's that at?
It's in
Sunshine. That's
filmed at Sunshine Village, yeah. Okay. In Banff. But,
dope.
Yeah, there was a lot of places and situations going into that, like pre-planning, but that was the place that worked out. But but then the, you know, the second Sammy Ortlieb creation, if you will, is like the following year in Zigzag for the water world. And then the third one being his animation segment, his, you know, his real piece de resistance this year in Romance. But he had been making these pump tracks that are kind of like an MC Escher style, you know, and Never Ending Staircase, where he had with his crew in Switzerland, where they'd build like these four corner track / mini ramps where you could, if you had enough energy, you could ride it as long as you wanted to.
Until your legs give out.
Right.
So he was like, he presented this to us as a feature segment, and he just wanted to do it with like full resources, like make it really proper.
Yeah.
And we were talking about like, oh, could we do it in a field in Montana? Like, you know, like ask a ranch somewhere. We wanted like it to be visually crazy, like very not on a mountain. And that's why, you know,
it certainly succeeds at that.
Right. So like, which almost was like, wrong with the Alberta location, because it was like very much in the mountains, but it was at a flat top.
Right.
But like, I think originally he wanted it to be in the flattest place in the world. So like in Nebraska or whatever, where you have like prairie and then people skiing because they can pump. It'd be like putting a mini ramp somewhere.
Yeah.
Anyway, we decided that it needed to be at a resort, because if you build it anywhere else, you're going to do a absurd amount of shoveling.
Yeah.
Like, resources.
Really absurd. Yeah.
Well, and you got to drag rails out and all that stuff. Yeah.
I mean, just even alone, what they did with the help of a park crew and cats was tons and tons of work.
Yeah.
But Sunshine Village had been made the holy bully set up. So they had a park crew that was very good at making like abstract creations, and they kind of, Sammy had like 3D mapped how to do this endless pump track, and they did it. The segment kind of doesn't fully get delivered in the way that I think he envisioned. For one, you can't fly a drone in Banff National Park. So if you had a perfect overhead view, it would have given it a different aesthetic, because you can
appreciation,
because you can never like see it, you can only see it like from the side.
The scale is kind of lost.
Not only the scale, but the actual flow of the lines, like, because it's kind of a figure eight is what it is. And also, I mean, the weather was brutal there too. There was like, it would snow every day on us.
Who shot this?
Johnny and Friedel.
Johnny shot most of it. I came in for like the last 2 days and helped them shoot some more of it. But
Johnny was saying that they, as a crew, had to clean off the surface 7 different times, and that they had to water it down. It was like maintaining a skate park service, because you don't want actual
or like
snow
a,
or pow.
A race course, too.
A race course,
because you're icing it. You want it to be as fast as humanly possible. And let me tell you what, those guys probably got like a year's worth of CrossFit.
They got their steps in.
Dude, it was like pumping that thing, like no joke. They were fully pumping around that track for a couple hours at a time, and it was intense. And then, like, even some of those times they were trying to do GoPro follow cams and stuff, and it was like, whoa, like they were,
dude, that must have taken an insane amount of patience from everyone. Oh, yeah. Like
Sandy trained for a year just for that shoot. Stairmaster in his basement. Like
when Rob Hewley falls over at the end of that part, that is out of pure exhaustion. Very real moment.
Yeah.
But yeah. It was really cool. And like they were breaking it down into little parts too, which like the mini ramp parts and stuff, they were really riding that thing like a skate, like they were skateboarding, and it was like genuinely fun.
Yeah, that's my favorite part of the segment is the like making fun of skateboarders when they're slapping their skis on the lips and then like pushing over the scooter kids.
Didn't they bring a scooter?
Yeah,
it was pretty good. But
there's little touches like that that make it fit even better in the like humor narration scale of the whole movie. Yeah. Like that's what I think it works really well, even though there are some things that could, some tweaks that might've worked out better, made it even better, but I'm a fan. And then obviously the animation, like stitching all the people together is like Sammy.
Those were stunt doubles. That was all in camera.
Yeah. That sounds like even harder than animating it together. Thane makes a return in this movie after closing out Pleasure, and I think has, well, maybe a longer appearance, more diversity, less heli stuff, some real bangers. That some of my favorite clips in the movie, and they kind of like mixtape it with Wiley, and I like
it's a split part, a split song,
But what was it like shooting with Thane that year? Was it a little mellower, like having sussed it out, not having to worry about heli time and that shit?
Yeah. I mean, I think that heli thing was such a one-off experience. Not only was he new to the crew, but it was also in this like crazy, not pressure cooker is not the right word, but just very one-off environment. Just helicopters and sending shit. And this year was more traditional, like, drive down to Utah, start the season off, build some jumps.
Yeah, he hits the Flagstaff gap in this?
Yeah, it's the upper
Flagstaff.
There's two Flagstaff, like, ravine gaps, which are old. You know, if you watch, like, Clay Pigeons and Wind Up Films movies, you see these jumps.
No one's hit that in a long time.
It hadn't been for a while, but
it's a huge build.
It's a huge build, and for good reason. That jump sucks. It's so bad.
Landing super flat.
Dude, it's terrible. Yeah. You need crazy speed. You can't hit switch. The landing's super flat. Gets sunbaked.
It's a great idea in 1999.
Yeah, it has an awful compression that you can't really ever fix, and you can never get like a proper pop on it. And everything is just so off.
And it's like an hour plus hike just up to the damn thing. And then it takes 4 days to build it, so you're basically like committing a week of your time to shoot this thing. And it sucks.
Yeah, so Thane had built it with like, I think Sander Hadley and like maybe Austin Romali, and they call me up like, yo, you want to come down and shoot these gaps? And I was like, yeah, I'll be down there. But I just showed up and filmed it.
And
it still sucked.
It still sucked. No, it really did. Thane was so exhausted from shoveling and hiking. He was trying to get like, I forget what actual trick he wanted on it,
a funky dub 10.
Exactly. Yeah, but like I was like carrying his skis up the in run, like doing laps with him because he was so tired.
And it still sucked. Yeah.
He got a really nice 9 on it actually. But I had literally filmed a Steel Spence doing a 9 on it in 2005 from the exact same angle,
the exact same rotation, too.
And rotation and everything. Super bolts, which is a dope, very awesome shot for 2005. But I was like, oh god. And then like we went back actually and hit it again, like the same,
and it still sucks.
Still sucked. Terrible jump. Like, don't build this jump. Like,
are you picking up what we're putting down, Connor?
And the only reason that Thane kept hitting it was out of sheer just pride for having spent 4 days building the damn. Such a dumb jump. Like, seriously, there are so many better gap jumps in Grizzly Gulch and Little Cottonwood Canyon. Like, upper Flagstaff Gap is such a bad one. For the record. Anyway, we did it.
It's cool that, dude, it's a throwback.
It's a throwback, and it was that's true.
It's a novelty.
It's not like lame to me that Steel hit it in 2005 and did the same trick. That's fucking awesome.
It's a callback. It's like an homage to the history of Little Cottonwood Canyon.
Yeah,
and it was actually really fun to shoot for that same reason, because we had been like, you know, on to the bigger and better things, kind of, and mm-hmm. then going back in and playing around with like building crazy jumps in Little Cottonwood Canyon feels like, like you're carrying on tradition in a lot of ways, and it's really fun.
That was one of the projects on my list for this year, was to go build Chad's, and it just never happened. And so in the entire...
What did you want to do on it?
I wanted to switch Dub 10.
That's respectable.
Yeah, I mean, talking next level, it's something that I've had on my to-do list for a while. And, I saw somebody switch Dub 10 in a movie once and figured that this is a good opportunity for me to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Yep. No, but for real, that's Chaz Gap, something that level one has never shot.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is kind of ironic, considering it's not quite in our backyard, but in a lot of ways in the crew's backyard, and even Pyramid, for all the amazing sessions that have gone down on Pyramid over the years, we just barely dabbled in that with Liam Downey.
Yeah.
A long time ago.
Some scraps.
We actually did put like a lip on it, but I wouldn't call it building it, because both those gaps require a great deal of in-run preparation and certainly a large jump to build.
Yeah, but I had big plans for Chad's this year. Did
you have someone on board to go hit it with you? If you can line it up?
Not going to talk about it, because maybe I'll still be able to do it one day, and it'll be very different and very cool.
Damn.
Oh, but actually, you built the quarter pipe in Chad's.
Oh, I know. That's
to be.
Probably didn't even quite realize strike it was three. Chad's at the time. We're like, this is a cool place.
Yeah.
Build a quarter. Send McMurray and
to the Biolo moon into the tree.
Cazotti in particular, he boosted the highest of that thing.
All right, let's talk about the Mammoth Park shoot. Going back to Mammoth, first time since Refresh.
Yeah, hallowed ground there. It's we have a nice history of working with Mammoth, where we've been able to follow in the footsteps of a snowboard super park, which is built a couple weeks before. And to an extent, we get sloppy seconds, but it doesn't really feel that way, because the features are just so amazing, and we get our pick of what we want to focus on. And we're also operating outside the confines of Super Park, which is like a very definitive window of time. And no matter what the weather is, they just have to go and do their best with it.
Mm.
And in this case,
That
played in huge, because they, I'd say like the standout features from that event were a hip and a jump. It's like a 120-foot deck on both of them.
Yeah.
That TJ, who's superstar builder of Mammoth for a number of years, that was like his shining glory of a project, was putting these two features together. And while the hip, I don't know if it quite really went off, but it went down.
Well, it went down in the most minimal capacity possible, because
it was terrifying.
It was absolutely terrifying. Whoa. It's definitely an example of like, progress has gone far enough. Like, sure. How big can you build a man-made feature? I believe, I don't want to speak out of,
throw it out there.
Well, I think that Mammoth, or TJ had even mentioned that Mammoth had invested $50,000 in cat time and snowmaking into building this feature.
They did.
Which is absurd. I believe that's a lot of resources.
Yeah.
And they built the biggest jump, I think, that I've ever seen. And at hip next to, adjacent to it, as Josh was saying, that's like equally on a different scale than ever before. But like they had one day that got the session at, because they had serious wind problems and any sort of wind resistance on that size jump.
Wait, well, Super Park had one day?
Super Park.
Yeah.
The Super Park had one day. Barely. And so,
like, borderline catastrophic.
Japanese guy had actually you can find this clip on YouTube, but he hit the hip and like went, he landed on the left side where there was no landing. He decked out on this monstrosity.
Going the wrong way, because it's a right-sided hip. You had to, like...
Oh. Yeah. And that kind of shut that down. And then they had hit the jump for a couple hours, and that was it.
In the morning.
And so they were like...
Yeah.
When we came in, they were kind of like...
We need something out of this?
Dude, kind of, man. It was like they had hit it and gotten play. Like, even just the shots. Like, I think there was one photo that was, like, of a snowboarder doing a, like, yeah, backside air on the hip that was, like, pretty sick. Mm. But it still, like, wasn't – it had not gone down in the way that it could have gone down.
Yeah.
And
not in what they envisioned.
So,
sure.
Yeah, like, they were like – I hope you guys have a better time on this thing, because, like, we did not build this and spend all this money for nothing. But the first thing we had him do was cut the hip out, because it was already melting, and I don't think anyone had much interest.
We did run an Instagram contest, having people estimate the size of the takeoff in Swadbergs, because I think that thing was an anomaly, man. Like, as far as, like, a tombstone, the standalone, like, maybe 8 to 10 foot wide thing that might have been 35 feet tall or something.
We were talking in iTrip about how disturbing it was to be on the lip of that jump all cut out. And that was mostly because of, like, how the jump was cut out. This actual cheese wedge
was a tombstone.
It was the size of a good size family home or something.
Like a three story.
It was disturbing. It really was like a nervous thing, like just a monolith of snow.
So borderline, fortunately, it melted out to the point where it was not really hittable, and we made the call to just have the whole thing mowed down, which is actually really fortuitous too, because that gave us an opportunity to shoot the jump on its own.
Yeah.
Because it opened up all kinds of different viewpoints where if otherwise the hip was kind of in the way, and all of a sudden...
Yeah, it's a little bit crowded even without it. Like, there's like... A lot of trees, a couple runs, a couple lift lines.
Sure,
like,
sure.
It's not bad, but it's not the, like, the refresh setting where it's just the jump and there's nothing else around.
Exactly.
It.
Yeah. Exactly. But for what it was, like, once we got to mow that hip down and just left this monolithic step over style jump that was like as big as you can really comfortably go. If it was another 5 or 10 feet longer to the deck or to the knuckle, I think that would have just been like a little bit too much.
It could have been, though, because the speed was not an issue as long as you didn't have a headwind.
Well, that's true, but just as far as, like, I think once the session
can go further.
Okay, all right, we can do more. And that said, it really was a perfect setup as far as in run where speed was not an issue. It was a beautifully cut, properly, you know, built transition and takeoff and landing. And it all really added up to the point where when people were hitting the sweet spot, impact was minimal. And it's crazy to think of traveling 150, 170 feet and having minimal impact. But it was there when you weren't overshooting it. Fortunately, undershoots were not an issue because I think everybody was just pointing it. But I know Chili went by, I think he speed tested.
So Chili was the... first person to hit this jump.
Self-appointed.
This is like built into a bowl. So you have the in-run's a bit intimidating when you're looking down at something and you're basically skiing for like 30 seconds before you're hitting a jump.
Yeah.
So
you have a long time to think about it.
Way too much time to think about it, dude. To the point where I don't think you properly even understand how fast you're going because you lose relative indicators or whatever.
You adjust mentally to your speed.
Chili had been like, Parker has a funny story about this because like Chili had been speed. They all had been speed checking it, just skiing up to the takeoff, just feeling it out. And so he skis up one time. And then he's like, yo, PY, is that like enough speed? And PY had not been watching him, had no idea what he looked like. And he's like, you totally, man, you got it. Because he's like, fuck it, it's up to you, dude. It's not up to me. Like, do you think that was enough speed? So he just gave him the heads, like the thumbs up.
He needed that confidence boost.
Exactly. He's like, dude, all he needed was a confidence boost.
Right? My spiritual leader, Parker, says it's good.
Dude, and he's like, I had no fucking clue how fast he was going. Like, I had no idea. Like, I was not watching him drop in.
Whoops.
But then Chili went and overshot that. Or he didn't actually overshoot it, but
he went as big as you can go, taking like it to the last tiny little bit of tranny where like another 5 feet he would have been in the flats and just barely held on. It was gnarly.
I know he was saying he had like multiple conversations with himself in the air.
Oh, well, you can hear him like he goes, "Oh shit! Damn!
Oh no! Oh god!
Oh no!" Like it's yeah. Yeah.
But he had like the come to Jesus moment for sure, where he was like,
"Yeah, talk about a long time to think about things."
And it's on a straight air too.
Yeah, it's on a straight air, which is like, yeah, as anyone will tell you that hits big air, there's like. You don't have any distractions from your end result.
Right. There's no grab to focus on. Right. It's just like rotation. Looking at the landing.
Sky whizzing around your head. Yeah. It's like the landing's getting closer, but it's still
really far away.
I'm going out, but not that far down yet.
Currently, the good landing is 20 feet underneath me.
Yeah, there comes a time, and I've actually like, done this myself way back in the day where you actually you see where you should land and it is so far below that it's fucking terrifying. Like
that's a pretty relatable feeling. You'll need to be hitting a big jump to overshoot it.
But
I'm not taking away from you. I'm not claiming
but just saying like on a big jump when you have that the time, if you will, to like have like clear, concise thoughts and or say things out loud after the point of like realization that you're fucked and before the moment of impact. It's like, damn it. But unfortunately, fortunately Chile survived that no problem. And then
he kind of bruised his heels maybe a little bit or
maybe a little bit, but then promptly went up a few hits later and trying to three it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. He went like,
that's the one.
I want to say like under rotated or maybe slightly over rotated. It's like something where he came down more or less at 90 and mouse trapped on the landing. And he said he couldn't feel his hands and his arms for like a little bit. And I mean, that was fucking terrifying. That's like another no
that crash isn't
situation.
In there, right?
It wasn't filmed super well because he hit it with somebody else who was speed checking tailing him.
Mm.
So I just remember when I was filming that crash in particular.
That's right.
I filmed Chile and then panned back. Because it was still like warm-up session.
Yeah.
And I panned back to like, I think Keegan was tailing him in. So I panned back to Keegan and then Chile did this horrible crash. Yeah. But basically, to understand how you're hitting this jump, he did I think he was going for a three. And there's so much wind resistance, not from actual wind itself, but from moving through that much air.
Mm.
That it can affect your rotation, right? So, like, he did a three and maybe couldn't fully rotate or over-rotate it or something.
It's one or the other, but he
based on like just the physics of him moving through air.
Yeah,
like for that much.
Well put, Friedel.
Yeah.
I guess you're getting that.
If he had done the exact same thing, the exact same speed, and set for like a nine, for example, he probably would have been fine. But just
there was discussion while these guys were hitting about how to like deconstruct your rotation and then reset it for this kind of airtime because. I don't think anyone had ever had this much airtime, and this includes the Sun Valley jump before and probably will never since. So they really had to like figure out what to do with those seconds of air and like, the physics of like when, you know, it's like how when you jump off a 90-foot cliff into water, like how that water changes it, based on velocity, right? It becomes like concrete versus just water, bubbly water. So like the same thing with air when you're moving through it. It's like these aeronautical physics that change and evolve, and it's a lot different than hitting a 35-foot park jump. But yeah, I mean, Josh mentioned Parker being the spiritual leader here. That was a huge part of this session because he
this back is, in the mix for the first time in a while.
Totally, since the first time in like
few years.
Four or 5 years, basically. Yeah, like cloudy. They were film. They were on their last season of filming for The Big Picture, and he was already camped out in Mammoth, and was like, I want to hit a big fucking jump again. But he had also like been, you know, Parker was living with me, and he was also basically like, we had had a discussion where he's like, I'm coming back. I would really like to rejoin the ranks in the coming season. And so low key, like on the super DL, like his joining the Mammoth session was just kind of his way of like coming back into the fold with us with Level One. And it was really fucking rad.
Yeah,
because him joining in the Mammoth session, you know, he's this like dude that was coming back as like, you know, it's like the elder, the wise elder returns, or he's back for him.
At age
like
26 or
walkabout. Yeah. 25. But
for all intents and purposes, like that is the role that he filled.
Yeah, 4 years and is a long time, regardless of how old
you
are.
He was completely the veteran. And like, he had such confidence, and he had hit all of these big jumps that Level One had made over the years prior, that he just had like such confidence. He's like, fucking, let me show you how to do this. Like, he ran
went through the library.
Dude, he ran a clinic on this jump. He obviously got his front flip in, dub 10. What's also really
switch 10 blunt, switch he did 10. Zero shift.
Okay, so he does a zero off camera.
Damn.
It's the most, one of the most fucked up slash like ill moments I've ever seen, because what was going on with this jump session is that there was a huge hang up with the drone. So Johnny Durst and Ian Relief were running drones, and they were doing tag team drone where one guy's doing the dual operator drone. There was a huge, there was like this massive battery pit stop, if you will, like every 10 minutes.
But you got to fly, and bring the drone back down, switch
this,
it up, that, put it
this
up
was
again.
Just really bad timing when, like, you know, it takes a lot of fucking nerves battling to build up confidence and gain momentum on this jump. So they were finally getting into a rhythm on the jump, which is no small task.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we got to take a battery break. And Parker was like, fuck this shit. Like, I'm not taking I don't care if the drone's running.
Yeah,
in the air, I'm gonna drop in. Meanwhile, Johnny on the radio, we're all on comm. We're all like filming from crazy points around this bowl.
Right.
So we're all on walkie talkies, and Johnny's like, battery break. So I'm like, thank God, I'm gonna move angles. And basically, everyone does this at the same time simultaneously.
Yeah.
I wanted to move down the hill 30 feet. Josh is there. Sean Logan's across the valley, and no one.
No one's watching the jump.
Dude, I'm watching the jump, but I got the stick camera over my shoulder. And I'm like, I look up, Parker drops and switch and does the illest zero spin. I can see it from far away, but I have such, you know, there's very few moments like this that I watch with my own eyes and not through a viewfinder.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you have got to be fucking kidding me. Like, he unlocked the zero. Like, no one had done anything like that. People were doing sevens up to this point on that jump, like discomfort sevens at that, and it just drops maybe it was had more swagger just because I watched it like not in the camera.
I think I like, got the shot.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, you got it from the back. So no landing. So it didn't. So Josh, Josh had the in run view and got the shot, but
take off.
Yeah. I watch from the side.
Shots.
Yeah.
Except that one time. No, but
I didn't see your landing angle on that.
Touche, touche. But yeah, I mean, like Friedel said, that is absolutely how these things go down, and it's this very choreographed thing where, you know, you're trying to all switch angles at the same time, and then
Parker's like, "Fuck that! Yeah. I'm feeling it."
Yeah. That's part of the challenge of these things too, is because when these jumps are so high consequence and such a mental game, it's like it's this dance around like making sure the athletes are feeling it and responding to them and their flow versus doing our best,
which is ultimately the most important flow to be
for
synced
sure
in
100% with. 100% there are also other things that are, you know, to some extent out of our control, like the necessity of changing the drone batteries, and like where do you draw the line? Like, what is the balance? And what is the appropriate trade-off? Do you just say, fuck it, and let the athletes do their thing and do your best to record it? Is that going to give you the best results? Or is it going to be cooperating and communicating with the athletes to some extent to have them responding to your camera angle switches and your battery switches. And there's no perfect answer.
Yeah.
And in this case, because the jump is so big and it really is this like mental thing that, you know, more or less we're running around trying to do our best to accommodate their headspace and right. their needs. And I will also mention before, like, we kind of, the stars had really aligned on this. For those that have not spent considerable amount of time in Mammoth in the spring, as beautiful as it is, the wind can just fuck things up.
We needed a zero wind day.
Which is like, you might get a couple a month if you're lucky. Yeah. And for those zero wind days to correspond with zero cloud days is yeah. another thing. Right. And it's just like, it all came together and we could not have been more lucky. I mean, it was really insane.
It was lucky. And like, yeah, I mean, like the airport in Mammoth Bishop is notorious for having like the sketchiest landing and departures because of how freaking windy that valley is.
Damn.
But yeah, the way, you know, like the Sierra is there. But yeah. Oh my God.
It was all time. It was like one of those sessions where just things are fucking awesome. And like,
yeah.
And then like,
so that was all one day.
It was all one day. Yeah. Basically an afternoon. It probably was like from 3 PM until sun went down. Yeah. 8 or something.
And I think really like all the shots that you're seeing are from like 6 to 8. Like once the light is like,
yeah, because that shadow line started creeping. Like even when Schwaz does that, switch semi trip. Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, like, yeah, back to Parker Zero, or switch straight air. Who invented the word zero spin? Doesn't really describe the trick very well, but,
yeah, no, cause you could go forwards and do zero spins exactly, as well. Yeah. Too. That's how
it's a switch zero spin or a switch straight air. Anyway, yeah. he did go back and do it again, just without as much swag.
Yeah.
And then Laurent does one as well, which is in the film. And he actually, that was a scary moment.
That overshoot is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gnarly.
It's super gnarly. But for the record, Parker unlocked that trick on the jump.
Parker unlocked that whole session.
He did. But man, when everyone got into their flow, like Keegan doing switch
dub nines, yeah. just like to the moon.
And Oliver Carlberg, I mean, say no more. Like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That like his.
Ends the movie.
Two iconic tricks like that.
Ended the trailer. Car
5 and the switch 12.
Yeah.
Is. Yeah, powerful. He's like, Oliver hit me back, I think last season, and was like, yo, man, like, can we do another jump like that Mammoth session? Because I really want to hit another jump like that. And it was like,
damn. That could be a once in a lifetime thing.
Yeah,
dude.
Like, let me go to the.
You got 50 grand?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, 50 grand and like the best cat driver / park jump builders in the world and like. There's so many things that have to come together.
Yeah.
I was like, that shit may never happen again. Sorry to break it to you.
On that topic really quick, just to talk about like the back end, like production, like from the producer standpoint of how some of this stuff goes down is that Level One fortunately has never been in a position where we have actually had to pay for the hard costs in some of these things. Because I think that this is on the extreme side, the fact that they probably did put 50 grand into this. Because I think one of the things that's very unique about this jump is that, as you suggested, Friedel, it's built in a bowl. So this is all snow that is stacked. There is no natural aspect of the terrain that's coming into play.
Mm.
Like, this is really a pile of snow that's stacked for this landing that's like 50,000 cubic tons of snow, or so? I don't know. I'm just making up numbers,
so much,
right?
Yeah,
but it's not like, oh, there's this there's not this natural like roll spot where there's a deck and they like, you know, stack
yeah,
up.
Yeah,
a little
yeah,
bit.
Just move the earth to help you out here.
This is all artificial
because they're optimizing the area for speed more than anything else.
Yeah. And they had, you know, the budget from Super Park or whatever that they were just playing with. Okay, we can make this happen, but. You know, our resort partners have footed the bill for actual like building these features always. But, you know, early on, like 10, 15 years ago, when resorts were really, I'm almost going to say like battling for position in terms of establishing themselves as having these parks, they were so much more open and available to putting time, money and resources into building whatever we wanted. And, you know, the past however many years, it's been that much more of a challenge. Like, for us to track down, for one, a resort willing to host a park shoot is step one. And then secondarily, to find one that wants to, you know, put some of their own money into building these things, because it's not an option for us. Like,
yeah,
you know, we have had resorts to say, cool, yeah, like we'll host you, like, you know, come at us with, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to build some of these things. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, I'm sorry, like we literally can't. Like, that is not an option. There's not a sponsor that gives us any kind of money like that to play with. But yeah, I mean, that's just definitely, you know, something that people have asked me about over the years, like, who pays for this and who pays for that? And I will say that these resorts have gravitated in recent years towards Mammoth in particular, towards working with brands on some of these shoots, and the brands actually pay for them. Because it's not like a traditional, like, you know, let's say, you know, Giro has built, you know, Hips on the Backside of Mammoth for a number of years. That's
or
not
the
like
Claw.
Or yeah, or Monster, you know, building stuff. It's not a
White Claw.
Park suits?
Different claw, man, different claw.
Hey, yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah.
They got money.
Yeah. White Claw, Green Claw. but yeah, I mean, it's very different. You know, our traditional, like, selling what Level One brings to the table is exposure through our media channels and whatever. We're not selling a product necessarily, but, you know, these brands come in and it's like, yeah, we want to do a park shoot to promote our goggles and our helmet and our energy drink. And it's like, or, you know, POV camera. And it's right. Like, oh yeah, like, you got to pay for that. Mm. Speaking of which, it's actually kind of funny. I think representative of like the headspace of these dudes on that particular jump in session is that we'd had a bunch of these Sony action cams that we had sent up with a few of the riders and, you know, talked to them about wearing them, because like, it'd be a crazy cool perspective that I still to this day have never seen a skier hit a jump that big. And like Laurent in particular, I remember like fully like planned on putting on this camera and then just like fucking forgot, like, you know,
yeah,
just like, nope.
Start speed checking in, everything else goes out of your mind.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like there's never a second thought about, oh, that's right. I don't know. Like, yeah. And, you know, for what it's worth, all those shots would have been in the movie and probably would have added, you know, 10, 20, 30 seconds to whoever's representation if it weren't it. But it was just such a like, all right, we're going to survive this thing. We're like, that is priority A1. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, everything else like is in the back burner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's some really cool, if you want to get meta about it, like symmetry in P-White returning to the mix in Mammoth, where he first came out west from New England when he made his journey at like 16, was around there for forever, and then showed up at the Refresh Park shoot, made his debut with Level One, and then now we're back here and he's getting back in the mix with all these other youngins like coming out the fold.
3 points of meta, I like it.
Yeah, that's very true.
Mm. Couple of things from the credits I want to one thing in particular that stuck out to me in the additional cinematographers list, which is, you know, has like athletes who run static shots, lock offs, whatever you want to call it, and like all sorts of people. I think Chewie's been in there before. Who's
we try to be generous,
right? The Cody Racing from Poor Boys. Poor Boys is not making ski movies anymore at this point, so I'm curious what he's doing there. Henny VJ and Forster Meeks, all three names that kind of seeing them in there, I'm like, well, how'd that person end up?
All right, I can answer a few of those. So for one, Henny was based out of Salt Lake. I think he still is based out of Salt Lake.
Yeah. Well, he joined us. He joined Thane and I.
Okay. He also shot a couple of LJ's clips. So, I mean, Freely, you could probably add to that, because all I was going to tell as far as the story was that at one point, Jake, who was working with LJ on his real ski piece with us, he was not around, and I think it was like Christmas holidays or something like that. And so LJ roped Henny in to shoot the flip up, the sunset.
Oh, really?
Up. Yeah, that was all Henny.
Damn.
Yep.
Good work, Henny.
Yeah,
absolutely. That's sick, because he was with LJ back in the real old days.
That's right.
Yeah. Yep. What else?
And so then Cody, who had just gotten his drone operator's license, was really keen just to like to learn and to put, you know, his skills to the test. And I mean, that's the thing about flying drones. Like, the more experience you can have, the better a pilot you will be.
Yeah.
And, you know, these real world situations are just, you know, really helpful. And so Cody was pretty keen on trying to shoot ski action, and more or less offered to come out on his own time and dime to shoot our park shoot with us. And interestingly enough, that's when he brought out Ian Avery Leaf as his assistant, if you will, through, I think he posted on like New Schoolers or something like that. Like, hey, I'm looking for an assistant to come help me shoot at the level one park shoot. And Ian was like, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And so like that's how, for one.
Yeah, you know, right. That was through old school style. New Schoolers.
Cody's like,
networking.
I think people still use this website. And so that's how all of that happened. And you know, Ian got his introduction to working with us, and we really liked having him around. He's a super nice dude and very talented. And then Cody came out for the better part of a week. Cody actually left a couple days before that jump session, and I think that there was probably a 3 or 4 day wind and weather hold break while we you know, waited for an opportunity to shoot that thing. And Cody had to take off and go back to his real job as a photographer in New York City. But that's when Johnny joined in to, you know, tag team the dual operator.
Yeah, sub him out.
Yeah.
Word.
Yeah. And then Meeks, for those that don't know Meeks, he's become quite a G in his own right with street stuff over the years. Shout out Meeks if you're listening.
Shout out the Hood Crew.
Yo. Yeah, the Hood Crew. But he is from Chicago originally, so he hosted I think Kai Capella when they went there for filming for X Games.
Yep. Okay.
So they,
I knew it had to be on some street lake.
Yeah,
but I was
they
just
were
kind
cruising,
of curious where that happened.
Cruising with Meeks, hitting spots with him. I think he knew spots to show them for one, but
sure.
Was hosting them, showing them around, being the guy, and to probably running winch, getting shots himself, filming all that good shit. When you're a part of a street crew,
yeah.
So I'm sure that Meeks was like a hell of a asset.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That helps so much knowing someone who can show you around, not just like driving around blind.
Yeah.
What is Google Earth?
Oh, dude.
Me.
In a place like Chicago,
yeah,
like,
<dude.
laughs> that's a big ass city.
Yeah.
Like,
yep.
You're going to be like a babe in the woods showing up shy.
Yeah.
After a snowstorm. Yeah. Just being like, let's hit some stuff.
Maybe we'll go check out the beans.
Yeah, the bean. Yeah.
Word. It's been suggested.
Oh. Word.
Yeah.
Sweet dudes. I think that's all I got. What do you got? Anything lingering?
I think we now know everything there is to know about Habit.
About skiing.
About skiing.
Dope. Well, glad to be doing this in person. It's nice to have you. I know, Friedel, you were on the fence about maybe coming. Denver's not your home.
It's not my home. But yeah. I had to come back with you.
Bust these out.
Fill us and do it up proper.
Friedel's second home is vacation house.
My vacation house is actually in Switzerland. So.
True.
Yeah.
Sweet.
It's workhouse.
Yeah, exactly. Word.
Until next time.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Peace out.
All right, sports fans, that's a wrap. Join us next week for Zigzag with Parker White and Chris Logan. In the meantime, make sure you go watch Habit while it is free for your eyeballs. All our other new movies free for your eyeballs as well for a limited time. Only 2 more weeks to go watch all these flicks. Go find some homies, have a ski movie night, get stoked for the season. While you're on the website watching all those movies, take a look at the Avenge page, find a romance screening, cop a DVD, cop some Wells Lamont. Find a way to support independent filmmaking. We appreciate all of you for listening. We will check in with you next week for Zigzag.